6 years ago, in a land far, far away. Okay, so it's not really that far away. One wrestling fan began his quest. A quest for the elusive Holy Grail of professional wrestling.
Holy Grail!
A search for something more elusive than Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. A search for common sense. He's still searching. This is the 300th episode of the Sala Monster Sounds Off.
And Big E chased after Ricardo. And holy shit, is this guy fast. You would think he was a Kenyan marathon runner. They win all the marathons, you know, those Kenyan runners. It's actually very unfair. He sent a tweet out that said, "These hoes think they classy. Well, that's the class I'm skipping." And he then quickly deleted the tweet and claimed that his account was hacked. So if you will indulge me for a moment, I'd like to read some of these lyrics. "I'm insatiable. I can't get enough. I need to find a boy. I need to find a boy," she says. Well, the music says. She doesn't say it herself. He really was not missed. Maybe by the kids. But fuck the kids. I don't care about the kids. I don't have any kids. "Oh, what you see is what you get. But just because you're looking, don't think you're home yet. Take your time, move slow, it's your best bet. This girl likes some sweet talk before she's all set." What is this, a Brazzers video? What the fuck is TNA's obsession with mystery person angles? It's a mystery how TNA is still in business. That's the real mystery. Fandango or Fandango or Fandang, go fuck yourself, whatever his name is. "You're so damn cute, but I've been here before. I know where this is going, so I'm showing you the door." I mean, just think about it. I mean, if Foley had more kids, what would he call them? You know, he already has Huey and Dewey. I mean, Gooey. Could have Gooey Foley. Could be Chewy. How about Chewy Foley? I took it to mean that he was back working with WWE again after years of being estranged, and he'd be around for appearances and a match here, a match there. Here a match, there a match, everywhere a match, match. "I'm insatiable, and what I need most is you to wrap your arms around me, baby, let's go. I'm insatiable, I need to find a boy." Okay, I think we get the point here. This song sucks. Everybody just seems to be glossing over these facts. The fact that he was a drug addict. The guy had a pharmacy in his own home. So in closing, Michael Jackson is dead. Let him rest in peace. Let him be buried, and let life go on. There's more important news in the world that we need to know about instead of knowing what killed Michael Jackson. Because quite frankly, I don't give a shit. The Sala Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You haven't been beat up properly!
Woo! Wow, I didn't realize I had such a foul mouth until I listened back to that. Jeez, gotta wash my mouth out with soap. Welcome to the tricentennial edition of the Sala Monster Sounds Off. Yes, it is episode 300, here on the 6-year anniversary of the Sound Off for Sunday, November 10th, 2013. I am the Sala Monster. You can listen to this show on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, or in iTunes, but you already knew that. I got to give a big thank you to my buddy, Noah, DJ Noah Mark, for his help with that awesome intro you heard there. You can also give him a follow on Twitter. His handle is at DJNoah80. So a big thank you to him for that, coming through at the last minute for me. And I also want to give a thank you to a couple of other people, Webmaster Mike, who you may remember from SEScoops.com. SEScoops was the home of the Sound Off for much of our run, up until a few months ago where we parted ways. And I want to give him a thank you because the whole genesis of the Sound Off really goes back to an idea that I had, or one of us had, I can't remember. But the idea was to do a show for the website, to bring some original content to it, and it just went from there. And I started doing one every week. It became a big staple of that website and really helped the show grow. So I want to say thank you to him for that. I also want to give a thank you to TV Tracks. TV Tracks has one of the more popular channels on YouTube. I know many people who listen to the show discovered the Sound Off through the various clips that are posted on TV Tracks. And he's been nothing but supportive, nothing but helpful in terms of promoting the show, getting more people to listen to the show. So give him a follow too. His channel, again, it's TV Tracks with an X. You could find him on YouTube. So a big thank you to him for that as well. I'd also be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to all the people who donated to the Sound Off via PayPal this week. PayPal is the easiest way to support the show. You'll see the little donate box over on thesolemonster.com. You know, again, you can donate any currency all over the world, and it really keeps this show going because we are an independent show. I do invest a lot of time, a lot of effort. This week in particular was kind of ridiculous, a lot of the prep that went into getting ready for the show. But I want to give a shout-out to all the people who did donate. My thanks to Leon from Philly, Michael Curtin, Michael Avila, Rodrigo Machado, Derek Davey, Jonathan Grunwald, Malcolm Mitchell, Pat Felker, Howard Kroom, Chuck Lentz, and Keith Krajnik. You guys are awesome. So I can't thank you enough for the donations that you made. And again, you can still contribute to the Sound Off. It's never too late. Do so on thesolemonster.com and just know that I very much appreciate that. As you might imagine, we have a lot to cover this week, a lot of ground to cover. We're going to talk about the terrible ending to Monday Night Raw. Chris Hero, released from WWE. I know many of you are curious for my thoughts on that. John Cena puts over Claudio, that's what he called him, last night in Munich, Germany. That was a really cool moment. I'll talk about that. We've got a mailbag fit for a 300th episode. It's just absolutely gigantic this week. So we're going to get to all that. I just want to give a quick plug to a new video that I put up earlier in the week. I'm sure many of you have already listened to it, but on our YouTube channel, my username is TheSolemonster. Please subscribe to us there. I put a new video up earlier in the week of an interview that I did, or that was done with me, I should say, with WrestleView.com. They have a show called The International Desk, which is a good show. You should check it out. It's one of their VIP podcasts. It's also part of a radio show that airs over in Dublin, Ireland. And I spoke with the host. We had a conversation that lasted almost an hour, talking mostly TNA. TNA is very big overseas, and particularly in that area. And so we talk a lot about TNA. We talk a little bit about WWE, and also about the genesis of the Sound Off, for some background for people who may not be familiar with the show. So he was gracious enough to allow me. He sent me the audio. I put it up on our YouTube channel. So if you want to check that out, I didn't mention it last week. It went up after the show was posted. So please log on, subscribe, and check that out. With that out of the way, let's talk about Raw. Monday Night Raw was live in Greenville, South Carolina this past week. We're going to get into the good, the bad, and the ugly, and there was quite a bit of ugly on the show. You know, leave it to WWE to rain on my parade and give me a bad Raw to have to review here on my anniversary show. We should be doing happy stuff here on this show. I thought the angle to close the show on Monday night was completely stupid. And since the entire show was built around this one angle, I thought it was basically a dull 3 hours. I sat there. I couldn't wait for the show to end. I'm just looking at the clock. It's like in sports. You run the clock out. That's what I felt like I was doing on Monday night. So CM Punk opened the show with Luke Harper. They had a match. I think it was their first ever singles match. Maybe they wrestled on the indies. I'm not really sure. Punk beat him with a roll-up. Good match. Fresh match. That's what I liked about it. It was a fresh match for a change. No arguments out of me on that. I talked about Harper possibly being the breakout star of the Wyatt family back in June when I first saw him on NXT. That's around the time, I think May or June, is when I started watching NXT. I think the clip is actually up on TV Tracks on YouTube if you go back and search for it. He's a big dude, which they love. He's a good wrestler, certainly better than Eric Rowan. They really play up his finish big, that spinning lariat. JBL even made a reference on Raw Monday to Frank Brody, as he called him, Bruiser Brody. I love how he just merges his real name with his stage name. And that's not a bad comparison for him to make, not at all. And even here, you know, Punk beat him, but it's not as though he beat him in decisive fashion. He didn't hoist him up on his shoulders and, you know, knee him in the face and pin him 1-2-3. Harper got a ton of offense in, and Punk only beat him on a fluky finish. So I think that's what we're starting to see here. You know, Bray Wyatt may still be hurt with that calf injury, which is why we haven't seen him wrestling much. But Harper's the one to watch out for, I think. And afterwards, the Wyatts all ganged up on Punk, which brought out Daniel Bryan with a steel chair and his hair pulled back in a ponytail. I guess that corporate makeover rubbed off on him after all. He cleaned house with Punk, chased the Wyatts from the ring. Bryan got a huge reaction from the crowd, everyone chanting yes in unison. I actually think he got the biggest reaction on the entire show, which is cool to see. It's cool to see that the fans haven't soured on him yet, despite the way they've booked him over the last month and a half or so. We got our first of many, 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 many promo videos for the Triple H Big Show Chronicles. Here, we got a replay of Big Show knocking out Triple H a few weeks ago. And then Triple H did an interview on .com a few days ago where he banned the Big Show for life. And that was the theme of the show, that Triple H banned the Big Show for life and, you know, what would happen now? And, you know, for a guy who's banned for life, they sure wouldn't shut up about him the entire show. I mean, holy shit. If I'm one of these undercard dingbats like Zack Ryder or even a guy like Dolph Ziggler, I'd want to be banned for life too. You'll get more TV time than ever before. So Michael Cole interviewed Paul Heyman via telephone from Europe, where he said he was getting treatment for the injuries he suffered at Hell in a Cell. Paul apparently wants nothing to do with Obamacare, I guess. He said he's been diagnosed with 2 herniated discs, a nasal fracture, swelling in his spine and his face. It's all good. You know, just talk to John Cena. He'll hook you up with his doctor. Get you back in tip-top shape within a month. You'll be good to go. They may even give you a world title match when you get back. So he then started crying. He hung up the phone. It all seemed very bizarre until I saw that the next segment was Ryback against the Great Khali. And then I realized why Heyman was probably weeping. The good news for Ryback is he won a match. The bad news is it was against the Great Khali. He won with the meat hook clothesline, so he didn't get to see Shell Shock after he beat up Santino and threw him into the barricade and then left. And I've noticed that in some of his recent matches, not here, but, you know, I think in the match with Cena on SmackDown, Ryback has been busting out the spear and the jackhammer, which I find very interesting. I think bringing in Goldberg would be the best thing for Ryback at this point. He's got nothing to lose. He's already dead. At least then, if they bring in Goldberg, it gives people an exciting undercard match for WrestleMania. And it gives Ryback something semi-high profile to do on that show. It's the best he could hope for. If I'm Goldberg, it's the only match that makes sense. Take the payday, you wrestle for 5, maybe 10 minutes. I don't even think the match should go that long. You pick up the win, because there ain't no way Goldberg's coming in to lose to Ryback. And then you leave. So I think for both of them, it's a win-win situation. Ryback losing to Goldberg, does it really even matter at this point? Like I said, it'll give him something high-profile at WrestleMania to do. He'll lose, and then he'll move on. We got Big Show video number 2 on the night. It's a replay of him beating up The Shield and costing them the tag team titles to Cody and Goldust. I hope you like replays, people, because you have plenty of them on this show. In fact, Del Rio beat Kofi in the next match, and immediately after that, we got yet another video, this time laying out all the reasons that the Big Show is suing the company, or threatening to sue WWE. I would list them here for you, but I don't give a shit. Speaking of things I don't give a shit about, up next we had the announcers explaining to us how to vote in the app on who would face Randy Orton in this next match, either Big E Langston, Dolph Ziggler, or The Miz. And on the subject of The Miz, I've had a lot of people email me, tweet me with a link to that video from Belfast earlier in the week where he came out and did a heel turn. He turned on the fans, he wrestled as the bad guy. He's done that, I think, in a bunch of shows on this international tour that they've been on. As far as I know, I think it's just they're short on heels and they needed him to go heel for the tour. I don't think it's the sign of him showing up on Raw this week as a heel. Maybe they're going in that direction. I think they should. I think he will turn heel at some point. But I didn't look at that and think, okay, that's the Miz heel turn. I think it was just something they had him do on the house show because they needed somebody in there against Kofi. So they showed Jerry Lawler voting for Dolph Ziggler. So he was the one, I guess. I tweeted that Langston would win, and he did. Just based on the way they've been booking these guys of late, he's the only one that made sense. Plus, at least it's a fresh match we haven't seen a million times before. I don't think Randy Orton and Big E Langston before Monday ever had a match. So Langston ran away with it. 75% of the vote he got to Miz's 13% and Ziggler's 12%. Yes, the Miz got more votes than Dolph Ziggler. I've got to give WWE credit. They do a pretty well awful job of pushing new names to the top. But they're awesome at burying guys just enough where the fans learn not to give a shit about them. So, well done, WWE. Well done. I almost forgot, before the match, Randy Orton cut a promo, which is not one of his strong suits. I wouldn't consider Randy Orton to be one of the better promo guys in WWE. He said all the women in the crowd were fantasizing about being with him right now while all the guys were jealous they couldn't be him. As one of our listeners tweeted, this was more sexual predator than apex predator here. It was a good showing for Big E. Orton gave him a ton of offense. The announcers really played him up like a big deal. JBL said he was a future world champion. He had Orton up for the big ending, but Orton slipped out, gave him the RKO for the pin. Up next, more Big Show replays. This time it was him knocking out Brad Maddox on SmackDown, and then Stone Cold Paul White driving a truck into the arena on Raw and stealing Daniel Bryan's yes chant. See, that's gimmick infringement is what that is. The big goof ought to be banned for life for that alone. Tyson Kidd made his first in-ring appearance on Raw in more than a year, teaming with his wife, Natalya, against Fandango and Summer Rae. Kidd won with the sharpshooter on Fandango. I'd get excited that they're finally going to give a push of some kind, find some role on the show for Tyson Kidd, but I know it's just to promote Total Divas, and when that runs its course, he'll be right back on Main Event. Total Divas returns tonight, by the way, for the second half of Season 1. I still have no plans to watch. I watched those first three episodes, and that was enough for me. I said that if they ever added AJ Lee to the cast, I might give it a second chance, but it's the same women. I think one of the storylines this season is that Natty pees her pants during a match. Have fun with that. John Cena, Goldust, and Cody Rhodes took on Damian Sandow and the Real Americans. This was the best match on the show, which isn't really saying much. It wasn't like this match had a lot of competition. Went about 20 minutes, and Cena played babyface in peril for a while before making the hot tag to the Rhodes brothers. When Goldust tagged in, the people went nuts for him. I mean, he says he's down to his high school weight now, which is about 220, and you can tell he is lightning quick when he's in there, especially on the hot tag. Sandow, I mean, you know, what more can be said? He's going around now claiming to be the uncrowned world champion. He's just a guy. He's a lot like Del Rio now in that they've stripped him of whatever made him unique, like the cartwheels. I know it's not a main event gimmick or anything, but I guess they don't want him doing the cartwheels anymore. With Del Rio, they got rid of Ricardo, and they got rid of the cars for his entrance. And when he turned back heel, they should have brought them back. I guess now they give him little Mexican flags in each corner of the ring, so I guess that's something. Goldust hit the final cut on Cesaro and got the pin. John Cena, I mentioned this earlier in the show, he put Antonio Cesaro over huge in Munich last night. Cesaro didn't beat him in a match or anything, but when the main event was over, I think it was Cena and Del Rio, Cena called Cesaro out from the back to help translate for him in German, because Cena speaks a lot of languages. He's actually learning Chinese, but I guess he doesn't speak German. So Cesaro came into the ring, and he had him translate some of the stuff he wanted to say to the fans. And Cena then started praising him. He was referring to him as Claudio. He was talking about how he came from wrestling on small shows to wrestling in front of thousands of people, and how one day he's going to be champion. You know, he's going to come back to Europe, and he's going to come back a world champion. And then he even handed him the world heavyweight title. Cesaro cracked a joke about how it had the wrong nameplate on it. It wasn't his name, I guess. And so Cesaro talked about how he got his start in Germany 12 years ago. And it was just a really cool moment, and from all the reports, it just sounded really nice. The video now is actually up on YouTube. I linked to it on my Twitter, so you can follow me, at Solomonster, and the link is up there. I posted it on Facebook as well. It's like a whole 8-minute video that somebody uploaded, and it's just a really, really cool moment. So hopefully that means big things for that guy in the future, because he certainly deserves better. I've been digging the Real American stuff with him and Swagger a little bit more each week, and he's certainly in a better position now than he was a few months ago, where he was just losing in singles matches to anybody and everybody. At least now he's getting some sort of push, but the guy deserves better. He really does. He's that good, and you can call him boring, you can use whatever words you want to use, but if you say that, your eyes are closed, okay? You got to open your eyes and actually see the guy for what he is. He's a great athlete. He's a great performer. He's actually very good on the microphone. You know, when he was the U.S. champion and they would do these YouTube videos of him going around when they would go to different cities and he would interview the local population, I thought that stuff was hilarious. And it was a side of him that we never really got to see on TV. So seeing that and seeing him back in the day, like in Ring of Honor and all that stuff, the guy's got personality. You know, it's like these dingbats who love going around saying, oh, Daniel Bryan's boring. He's got no personality. You're an idiot. You are an idiot if you honestly believe that. And if Cesaro has a big fan behind the scenes in John Cena, then you know what? That's good for him. They aired the same Big Show video they showed us earlier, laying out his case against WWE. And at this point, I realized this is becoming a huge problem for this show. It's 3 hours long, and every single week it feels like we're getting more and more replays of all the shit that we already saw. Yeah, it's like they're just filling time. For me, that's a total channel changer. It's like they're just screaming to people to not watch the show live and instead just watch it on DVR. And I don't know, maybe that's the answer. Maybe I should watch Raw in pieces over the course of the week. The problem with that is I know myself, and I know my schedule, and unless I watch it live, there's no way I'm ever watching a full episode of Raw ever again. I'll either be too busy, or I'll find other stuff to do, I'll have other things to watch, NXT, Impact, or whatever, and I just won't get around to it. Some people can do that, God bless them. That's just not how I watch TV. So for now, I have to suffer through this shit. When it was over, who should we see backstage but the banished Big Show, smiling in a suit and tie. So the band lasted all of what, about 8 segments? I'm surprised they made it that far. Dolph Ziggler beat Curtis Axel with the zigzag. The title did not change hands because it doesn't mean anything anyway, so who cares? They announced Axel vs. Langston on main event for the title. That was the match they advertised but ended up pulling from the Hell in a Cell pre-show. And wouldn't you know it, main event came and went this week and no Axel vs. Langston match. I was so pissed off this match didn't air, said absolutely no one in the entire world. This is what happens when you book guys in a way where nobody cares about them at all. And I'm talking about Axel. I'm not talking about Big E. Same goes for Dolph. I just don't care anymore. Eva Marie and the Bellas beat AJ and Tamina after Eva Marie pinned Tamina with WWE's favorite finish, the dreaded roll-up. Diva stopwatch had this at 3 minutes 11 seconds. Eva did nothing the entire match. She just stood there, tagged herself in, got the pin after Tamina missed her Superfly Splash. I can't believe I'm saying this, but TNA is doing a better job with Lady Tappa than WWE is doing with Tamina. And they did it first. TNA copied off them, and they're doing it better. Brie is getting better each week, little by little. And if you want to know why, it's because apparently before each show, she spends 2 hours in the ring learning with Daniel Bryan. If you can't get better that way, then you're a lost cause. Which brings us to the closing segment of Monday Night Raw. Once again, headlined by The Big Show. 5th straight week that Big Show has headlined Raw in some capacity, either by interference or promo or whatever. Anything but wrestling. He's highlighted 5 episodes of Raw without wrestling a single match, which is very impressive. I thought the angle that ended Raw was completely stupid. I just want to get that out of the way first. The only redeeming part about it, the only part, was the debut of Libertarian Kane. I don't remember how many months ago it was on the Sound Off that I pitched the idea for this character. I definitely didn't think it would happen this soon, but there he was, dressed in a suit and tie, walking down the ramp, and to all the people complaining that they killed the Kane character, the Kane character you're referring to, died years ago. I still like Kane. I liked him with the mask, but at some point, you gotta try something new. It just gets stale after a while. I mean, look at The Undertaker. All the transformations, right, that he underwent all those years, from, Dead Man Taker to Biker Taker, Big Evil, whatever the hell that version of The Undertaker was with the teardrop on his face. I guess he must have murdered somebody. I don't even know what that was about. But he went through multiple transformations over the years. Now he's back to being the Dead Man, and people still love him. So I'm sure we haven't seen the last of Evil Monster Kane, believe me. I, for one, am very bullish on the character. And speaking of bullish, it's a great segue, I can't be the only one who saw Kane on Monday and thought, what's Bull Shannon from Night Court doing on Raw? That's a very underrated show, by the way, and I know there's a lot of people listening to this who have absolutely no idea what Night Court is. It was a great sitcom from the 80s, and the actor who played this court bailiff, this big, tall guy, Bull Shannon, it was played by this actor, Richard Knoll. Was it Richard Knoll? Richard Mole, I think his name was. If you do a side-by-side comparison of what Richard Mole looked like back in the mid-80s and compare it to what Kane looks like today, dead ringer. Dead ringer for Kane. I wonder if the show even airs anywhere. All these TV shows, these sitcoms that get replayed, they're in syndication here in the States on like cable and all that. Night Court used to be, but I haven't seen an episode of that show in years. I remember reading that. I think there was like a network in Canada that showed episodes of it. Maybe one of our Canadian listeners can verify that. But anyway, Triple H announced on .com this past week that Kane's new role is going to be that of WWE's Director of Operations. I'm not quite sure what that role entails. This was not explained. But I just think it's nice to see the two of them set aside their differences after Triple H accused Kane of being a murderer and all. Very reassuring. And to all the TNA idiots saying they're copying Joseph Park with this new character, I guess because he wears a suit, go drink bleach, okay? Unless he comes out on TV this week claiming he hasn't seen his brother since the Wyatts kidnapped him at SummerSlam or some shit like that, it's not the same thing. Stop being stupid. Story here is that the board of directors has told Triple H and Stephanie they want this case settled with the Big Show because if his lawsuit moves forward, it could severely harm the health of the company. Hence why his lifetime ban lasted all of 5 days. So they ask him what he wants. Big Show says, "All I want is my job back. That's all I want." Now, think about this. We had to sit through multiple video packages telling us that the Big Show was suing for being harassed, he was defamed, whatever the reasons were they listed in that stupid video. He's been bullied and harassed by Triple H and Stephanie every single week. You're a freak. You'll never find work outside this business. You're a giant, and so that means you're going to die soon. Stephanie said, "I spoke to your wife, and she said you had a tiny dick. You're worthless. You have no soul." All of these horrible things they said to this poor guy for months now. And all he wants is to get his job back so he can go back to working for the same people who tormented him in the first place. Not too bright, is he? Not too bright. Of course, he also wants a title shot against Randy Orton at Survivor Series. Triple H refuses at first. Big Show says, "Okay, well, you'll be hearing from my attorney tomorrow." And so Triple H relents. He says, "Wait a minute. Fine. You got your title match." Here's a fun fact for you. The last time the Big Show challenged for the WWE Championship at Survivor Series was in 2002. That was when he beat Brock Lesnar. Before that, he wrestled for the title way back in 1999. It's now 14 years later. Both times, by the way, he was successful and he actually won the title, so the odds are in his favor. I don't blame him for wanting his title match at Survivor Series, even though I don't think he's winning this time. But that's not the point, though. The point is that fucking Big Show is in the championship main event at Survivor Series. Big Show versus Randy Orton and John Cena versus Alberto Del Rio are your top two matches for the pay-per-view. That sucks. There's no other way to say it. It just sucks. I saw these two wrestle in an undercard match with no titles on the line at Extreme Rules earlier this year. I didn't care to see it then, and I care even less to see it now. And what makes it worse is that the issue isn't Orton versus Big Show. It's Big Show versus Triple H. It's the same thing they did with Daniel Bryan. The way they built that whole thing up, it was never really about Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan. The real feud they were building was Daniel Bryan against Triple H. And they wonder why Night of Champions and Battleground did so poorly. Randy Orton, he's just a body to strap the belt around. That's it. You could replace him with a mannequin during these segments and nobody would notice. The one positive, and this is really reaching here, I was really reaching to find something positive to say about this. The one good thing about Big Show giving up millions of dollars for a title match, at least it makes the championship seem important, which is more than I can say for all their other titles combined. Big Show said it himself, you know, he could have ended up owning the company had that lawsuit moved ahead and if he would have won. And instead, he gave it all up just to get his job back and get a title match. At least they're trying to make the WWE title seem important. But, I mean, Jesus Christ, I can't believe we've got Big Show challenging for the title in the Survivor Series main event. I got to give credit to Mike Shannon over on PWMania.com. He made a very good point, and a startling one, I thought, in a column that he did this week. Between Triple H, Big Show, and Randy Orton, those three men have spent a combined 43 years on WWE television. 43 years! That's more time than I've been alive on this earth. And maybe that's just the product of the way TV is these days, as compared to, you know, when I grew up in the 80s. You didn't have the big stars on every single show. Yeah, they do that on NXT now. I actually think they do a good job on NXT of rotating talent out. I just got a question about this from somebody earlier this morning. You'll have a few weeks go by where Bo Dallas or Sami Zayn or whoever the top guys are, they don't appear on the show. 2, 3, 4 weeks will go by. Not everybody is on every single show. That's kind of the way it was back in the day with the main shows. You also didn't have 3 hours of Raw every week. You didn't have 13 pay-per-views each year. And guys didn't just hang around as long as they do now. Guys jumped to WCW, or they left for a while and they came back. Look at a lot of those guys. Hogan, Warrior, you know, Mr. Perfect, Jake the Snake. These guys spent a fraction of the time in WWE on television every week that the guys today do. John Cena's been around for 11 years. Randy Orton's been around for 11 years. Big Show's been around for 14 years. Kane has been around for about 15 or 16 years. Triple H has been around almost 20 years. It's not hard to see why people are sick and tired of seeing the same stuff over and over again. You see them on Raw for 3 hours, 2 hours on SmackDown. They even have those annoying Raw rebounds now on NXT. It's like you can't get away from it. Triple H was apparently really pissed off when they went to commercial. They took a commercial break right in the middle of this segment. I think the segment was going long and they queued up the Shield's music too early. He grabbed a headset from ringside and was lacing into somebody in the back, cursing him out. Whatever it was, he was clearly upset. He should have been upset at the booking of this show. That's what he should have been upset about. After being upset for his treatment the past couple of months and finally getting his job back, what do we see when they come back from commercial? Triple H immediately puts the Big Show in a handicap match against Randy Orton and the Shield, and they all gang up to beat the shit out of the guy. So Big Show manages to fight them all off. He gave a wicked chokeslam to Roman Reigns. You don't see Big Show bust out the chokeslam very much anymore, but that one looked pretty sweet. This is the part where Libertarian Kane made his debut very calmly, walking to the ring in his suit and tie. He tossed some chairs into the ring, as any good Libertarian would do. That distraction was enough to take down the Big Show. They all took turns giving him chair shots. They beat him up some more outside. And then the Shield gave him the triple powerbomb through the announce table. And they had some trouble getting him up, but they got him up. They all said, "Welcome back, Show," and that was Raw. Big Show and Randy Orton in the main event of Survivor Series. Just ridiculous. The crowds are reacting to Big Show. I will say that. It's not as though the people don't care about Big Show. At least if you watch the shows, they react pretty big to him. But that's because they want him to kick Triple H's ass, not Randy Orton. So when Survivor Series does poorly and the buy rate comes in, I wonder who they're going to blame. Remember, Vince McMahon just did that conference call. He said, pay-per-view is an attraction-driven business. Well, right now I fail to see what the attraction is. News broke on Friday that WWE had released Cassius Ohno down in developmental, the former Chris Hero, who has worked all over the world for a ton of different promotions, Ring of Honor, CZW, Chikara, Pro Wrestling Noah over in Japan. This was more surprising to me than it should have been, probably because I just got done watching Ohno in the main event on this week's NXT. Plus, he just came back with a better physique, which was supposedly the reason they pulled him from the show over the summer. He was criticized by a lot of people in developmental for not taking his workout regimen seriously, and they felt that his, I guess, physique wasn't where it needed to be. So he worked on that, came back. And there was a noticeable difference. I mean, you can't change your body type. Cassius Ohno, to me, always had this very lanky, weird body type, very much the way that Christian does. Christian just has a weird body. I always thought that. And you can't really change that. But clearly, he was in better shape than he was a few months ago. You know, he worked on that. The announcers were even praising him for it on the show this week when he was wrestling Luke Harper. They were making comments about how much better the guy looked. So what the hell happened? Did he do or say something to somebody that got him fired? Was it a disciplinary thing? There's no indication of that. According to PW Insider, Ohno was at the Performance Center on Friday morning getting ready to begin his training when he got told of his release. So it doesn't sound like something that he requested or that he asked for. We don't know the reason right now. Right now it just reads like a really dumb move on WWE's part. And WWE's loss is going to end up being somebody else's gain. I know WWE likes doing their own thing and not borrowing stuff from the indies, but I keep reading that Triple H is making tag teams a priority again in the company. If tag teams are such a priority to them, then why did they never consider putting Ohno and Cesaro together as a team? Those two guys were great together as the Kings of Wrestling. When I was more into ROH back in the day than I am now, they were one of my favorite acts there. For the longest time, they were doing nothing with Antonio Cesaro. They were doing nothing with Cassius Ohno down in NXT. That would have been the time to put the two of them together and see how they do. I mean, look at what they're doing with Cesaro now. He's in a tag team anyway. They put him with Jack Swagger. Now Cesaro's getting over with the giant swing stuff. But so what? He could have gotten over with it just the same had he teamed up with Cassius Ohno. Those two guys, they had a chemistry together. They cut really good promos. They played well off each other. They never pulled the trigger on it. So now they've got this directive, I guess, to scout for more tag teams or create more makeshift teams down in NXT when they had a great tag team right under their noses and they were too stupid to realize it. Either too stupid or too stubborn. I'm not sure which. Some of the biggest wrestlers of all time, they started in tag teams. Great tag teams, too. Shawn Michaels with the Rockers, Bret Hart with the Hart Foundation, Steve Austin. I mean, really, Austin first got noticed in WCW as part of the Hollywood Blondes with Brian Pillman. These two guys could have worked together, gotten over to the point where, let's say, Cesaro eventually goes babyface and gets over with all the strength stuff and the power stuff, and Ohno goes off on his own as a heel, and you've got two stars made. So I just think it's a big mistake. I admit, you know, Cassius Ohno wasn't exactly lighting the world on fire during his time in NXT. He wasn't the best wrestler there. But I wonder how much of that was them just not really giving him a chance to show what he's got. I think that, you know, Ohno gimmick could have gotten over, but maybe it's the best thing for the guy. Now he can go back to being Chris Hero. He's already getting a ton of independent offers. He's already booked to wrestle Hurricane Helms on the Pro Wrestling Syndicate show in Jersey next Saturday. He'll be appearing as part of the Pro Wrestling Guerrilla All-Star Weekend next month. If Ring of Honor and TNA had any sense about them, they'll both look into signing this guy. TNA especially, you know, because they went and signed Derek Bateman, who was released from NXT earlier this year, and they just debuted him on TV as Dixie Carter's nephew. You can't tell me that Derek Bateman is a better worker than Chris Hero. And with Hero, the guy's got personality. He's got more than Derek frickin' Bateman, I can tell you that much. TNA wants to get serious about signing new faces? Hero's not that young. I actually thought he was a little bit younger than he is. Apparently he's 33. But he's got a lot to offer. He can work with guys like Samoa Joe, Austin Aries. You know, he's worked with them before. I'm sure there's a chemistry there that would probably make for some pretty entertaining television. TNA passed on guys like Daniel Bryan and El Generico when they had the chance. They brought them in for tryouts, and they passed on them. Don't make the same mistake with this guy. Even though you know Hero probably can make more money on the indies than he would with TNA. Even Daniel Bryan said the same thing in an interview. I think it was around SummerSlam time. If WWE let him go, he said he'd end up making more money on the indies and doing some tours of Japan than he would in TNA. Bryan's a much bigger star than Chris Hero, but believe me, Hero will not do badly for himself on the indies right now, would be my guess. Still worth it, I think, if you're TNA or ROH to look into the guy. WWE's loss can be their gain. NXT opened this week with a backstage shot of Sylvester Lefort, talking to the mystery lady who's been coming out during Alexander Rusev's matches. He was pleading with her for answers, but she just said some stuff in what I assume was Bulgarian. She actually sounded just like Oksana here. And then she shooed him away. Poor guy. She's stealing his client. That's not right. Got Big Show stealing Daniel Bryan's chin. Now this chick comes in, she's stealing this guy. What's going on in this company? Whatever happened to ethics and morals in pro wrestling? Out comes Lefort for a singles match against the Bulgarian Brute and his new girlfriend. We're told that her name is Lana. Lefort tries to bribe Rusev with a wad of cash. Instead, he gets mowed down, puts him in the camel clutch, which they refer to as the accolade, and Lefort taps out. This is really more an angle than a match. Rusev is just such a massive guy. I expect him to be fast-tracked to the main roster probably within a few months before even Sami Zayn or Paige make it because, you know, they're into big guys again. I've got nothing against having big guys on the roster if they're talented, if they've, you know, got charisma, they're entertaining. By all means, let's see what they got. I do wonder how well he's going to get over, though, playing the prototypical foreign monster, though. He's out there barefoot, basically wearing a loincloth. But then again, you know what? They put Umaga in the Battle of the Billionaires match at WrestleMania, so who knows? Umaga was a talented big guy, but with that gimmick, in a match like that, with all that mainstream publicity, you're using a guy playing the role of Samoan Savage who grunts and doesn't speak English and has fake tattoos all over his face. I always thought that was a bit silly. But that match was going to draw no matter what because of Vince versus Trump, so I guess it didn't really matter who they put in there. To the back, Charlotte hands Bayley a headband that she repaired. I wasn't aware that Bayley had a broken headband in the first place, or why I should care, but okay. Summer Rae and Sasha Banks sashay into camera view, and they offer a brand new headband to Bayley, who throws the other one on the floor, and she wears the new one. Summer and Sasha clearly trying to win over Bayley as their friend or slave or something, and Bayley is just too naive to realize it. Charlotte sees what's going on here. She steps in, which prompts Summer Rae to bring up Charlotte's personal issues, I guess referring to Ric Flair. Ric Flair is now officially a personal issue. Charlotte responds with this great line about how she doesn't need Summer Rae's advice. She says, "I don't need another stepmother." That was a sick burn right there. I would love to know who scripted that line. So this was good. Leo Kruger returned for the first time since Antonio Cesaro laid him out with a beating several weeks ago. He beat El Local here, who got lots of Ricardo chants. Kruger looks and acts exactly the same, so I'm not sure if he's supposed to be a face now or a heel still. He still does that, you know, hoo-hoo-hoo thing that Jimmy Snuka used to do, and the fans chanted along with him. Leo Kruger is a good wrestler, but I don't know. I just don't find anything exciting about the guy. I think if he ever gets called up, he'll be a solid mid-card heel for them to have. I don't think he'll really be much more than that. We got a recap of the ongoing storyline with Paige and Emma, with footage of them arguing backstage last week after Emma accidentally nailed Paige. Emma ran down to save Paige from beatdown from Summer Rae and Sasha. Paige does not care much here for Emma's explanation. She threatens her, and then she walks off. Why are neither of these women on my TV on Mondays? AJ is pretty well out of opponents, I think, after she wrestles Natalya, if she ever does wrestle Natalya. So I think it's about time they get some fresh faces on the main roster who can actually wrestle. Eva Marie does not count. The Ascension beat two guys named Travis Tyler and Troy McClain in a quick squash. Same thing with the Ascension. I'm getting bored with them. You know, they want new tag teams on TV. There's one they can bring up. They can still wrestle on NXT. They did that with the Wyatts for a while and the Shield. Even after they made it to the main roster, they still appeared on NXT. I understand this is a developmental show, so, you know, maybe they don't think these guys are polished enough yet. They want to give them some more time, but, you know, for what these guys do in the ring, they're fine. Their act is very basic. They go in there, they use a bunch of power moves, they beat people up, they finish them off. End of story. They're not in there working a great psychological, technical masterpiece. That's not what the Ascension is all about. I see nothing wrong with them. You know, either shit or get off the pot with these guys. Make up your mind. One sign that they may be headed to TV is that their names have changed slightly. I noticed on Twitter a few days ago, Connor O'Brien is no longer Connor O'Brien. He's now just Connor with a K. Rick Victor is now just Victor, again with a K. I approve of this. The name Connor O'Brien for a guy with this gimmick was kind of silly. Not very menacing at all, so I think this fits them better. Mojo Rawley, he who don't get hyped, he stays hyped. That's his gimmick. He beat newcomer Ty Dillinger, who I did not recognize, but I came to find out afterwards that Dillinger is the former Shawn Spears, who had been signed with WWE several years ago. He debuted on the ECW roster as Gavin Spears, and then he got released. So he signed with the company a few months ago. This is his new gimmick. He got some offense in here, but the match was all about showcasing Rawley. Rawley is still very green, but I think it's only his second match, so I think you can excuse that. He's still very new to the wrestling business, but he's got something. They obviously like him because of his size. He's a former NFL player, but he's got some charisma, too. He did look a little lost in this match here. Towards the end, Dillinger hit him, and then instead of firing back, he just kind of stood there. It looked like maybe he was going to fire back, and he was just like, you know, come on, do something here. And instead, he just shoved him. So he'll work on that. You know, he's got time. He won with the Earthquake Splash. Still a very odd finish for the guy. He sure does love using his ass. I'm just glad I don't have to wrestle the guy. We got another frickin' Raw rebound on this show, so that damn thing has permanently infected the show. Like a terminal illness. The good thing is that at least they didn't insert it in the middle of a match, the way they did last week. Main event was a rematch from a few weeks back between Luke Harper of the Wyatt family and Cassius Ohno in his final NXT appearance. The fans in the NXT zone love the Wyatt's entrance. They do the deal where they sway back and forth to the music. They can't do that on Raw because they turned the lights out for their entrance, but I guess if they didn't and people started swaying, it would get them over as babyfaces. So it's probably for the best right now. Harper is really good. I really appreciate the way he plays his character. He reminds me a little bit of Mankind whenever he starts doing that, you know, yeah, yeah stuff. It's like when Foley used to make those weird you know, like, atze noises, and he would start ripping hair out of his head. Very freaky. It's little things like that that I appreciate. They had a good match, pretty long, too. They went almost 15 minutes. Dragged a little bit in the middle, but it's just the way they paced it. Ono nearly picked up the win after an elbow strike, which he uses as his finish, but Harper kicked out. That move, the elbow strike, was given to Cassius Ono by the late Mitsuharu Misawa while he was in Japan, which tells you how much respect Misawa must have had for Ono when he was over there. Ono's actually worn a shirt with Misawa on it on NXT a few times. So who the hell knows? Maybe that's why they released him. Be honest. Would you really be all that surprised if you found out that was the reason? These people are nuts. Harper finished him off with a great-looking lariat, got the pin, so he wins the rematch, as well as the first match. But he's the guy on the main roster, not Ono. After the match is over, we fade to black with a disappointed Cassius Ono leaving the ring to some respectful applause from the NXT faithful. Rest in peace, Cassius Ono. Welcome back, Chris Hero. Bad move on WWE's part. I thought NXT was a good show this week. Had just the right mix of wrestling and some storyline advancement. Next week, it's Summer Rae and Sasha against Paige and Emma. And Adrian Neville gets Corey Graves in a 2 out of 3 falls match. So that should be good. Now let's move on to the Impact Report. No major TNA news this week. Still lots of rumors of a potential sale. People in serious discussions to possibly buy the company. Apparently, it's not Billy Corgan. It's not Eric Bischoff. But despite whatever they may say, there are discussions that have taken place. Aside from that, no major news on the TNA front. That's a good thing. No news is good news for TNA these days. Impact opened with heel Dixie walking backstage with her big surprise, the former world champion she teased earlier in the week on YouTube. For those of you who may have missed it, Dixie Carter posted a video during the week claiming that she received a phone call from somebody she called a former world champion. And in her words, one of the greatest of all time, that they would be showing up at Impact in Cincinnati this week. Yes, yet another internet tease from TNA. A few days later, they posted another YouTube video. This time it was showing Jeremy Borash, and I think it was Dave Lagana, who writes for them, sitting in Dixie's office trying to guess who the person was. They were spitting out names like Raven and Kevin Nash and Rhino, and she just kept batting them down and saying, nope, nope. And finally, she confessed it was Adam Pac-Man Jones of the Cincinnati Bengals. And Borash and Lagana just looked at each other with these confused looks on their faces, as I'm sure all the fans at home were. And I figured that meant that it really wasn't Pac-Man Jones. It was just Dixie's way of trolling the internet. But nope, it really was Pac-Man. The same Pac-Man Jones who held the tag team titles with Ron Killings years ago in TNA, even though Pac-Man wasn't allowed to get physical, and so they had Xavier Woods represent him as Ron Killings' tag team partner. The same Pac-Man Jones who was involved in that Vegas nightclub shooting that resulted in the club manager, a former pro wrestler, getting shot by one of Jones's friends, and he ended up paralyzed from the waist down. I just got done talking about this whole thing on the Sound Off in the last couple of months during the This Week in History segment, and about what an embarrassment it was for TNA to even be involved with the guy. And here they are, 6 years later, getting involved with him again. I wasn't bothered by what a letdown the announcement was. I assume that was by design, since Dixie's a heel now. It was her way of pissing off the internet fans. I don't give a shit that it wasn't Jeff Jarrett or Ken Shamrock or whatever other ex-champion they wanted to trot out there. Who cares? I have a problem with them doing anything with this clown again. Dude's been arrested at least 7 or 8 times. Didn't he just get arrested again for something like 2 months ago? Thought I read something that was pretty recent with him getting arrested again. I guess they figured it would get them publicity. This is definitely not what I meant when I said TNA needs to work on publicizing and marketing themselves better. And Impact's rating actually went down this week. So, whatever. It was a one-night thing. I won't have to look at the guy's face again. And fuck the Bengals for what they did to my Jets a couple of weeks ago. Main Event Mafia came to the ring in suits, except for Kurt Angle, who couldn't be bothered to dress up. Remember last week when I said I thought they did a good job with the show-closing angle with Kurt Angle, and what a great sell job he did in that video they posted online of him being tended to by doctors backstage? You'll be happy to know he showed up on this show selling absolutely nothing and showing no ill effects whatsoever from what happened last week. Last week, the show ended with them teasing that Kurt Angle might die. And this week, he's fine. Sting said the Mafia was created to get rid of Aces and Eights and get the world title off Bully Ray. Since both of those goals had been accomplished, it was time for them to go their separate ways. He said he loved them all. He hugged Joe, he hugged Angle, Magnus, and then he left, never to be seen again. Perhaps he left for WWE? Who knows? Time will tell. This may have been the nicest breakup of a faction in the history of wrestling. I think more tag teams and stables should break up this way. Joe took the mic. He said he's waited far too long to hold the title again. He said he would go through Kurt and Magnus if he had to in the tournament to get the championship, and then he left. Magnus basically said the same thing to Kurt, then he walked out, so this left Kurt Angle all by himself. He started talking when Bobby Roode came out. He was pissed that Kurt could not just admit that he lost back-to-back matches to him. He said if he meets Kurt Angle in the tournament, he'll kick his ass for a third time. And so they ended up in a wild pull-apart brawl. They went to commercial. They came back from commercial. Kurt was still in the ring. He was sitting in the ring waiting for Roode to come back out. He did, so they had to be broken up again by security and road agents. Bad Influence came out. Joe and Magnus came out. The fighting continued. This was the longest pull-apart brawl I've ever seen, but it made for the hottest open to Impact that I've seen in months. Angle and Roode is the best thing going right now in TNA. And the best part is that it propels Bobby Roode back into a headline feud on TV for the time being. He's been relegated to the undercard for so long. Now he's in the TNA title tournament. He's feuding with Kurt Angle. He main evented the show last week against Kurt. I'm happy to see it. Daniels and Kazarian, they started mouthing off to Pac-Man Jones and some other Bengals player that I don't know, DeQuinn something or other. They both hopped the security railing and started brawling with Bad Influence in the ring. This was more action than Pac-Man Jones saw his entire 3 months in TNA the last time he was here. And he won a championship back then, so think about that. They gave stereo body slams to Kaz and Daniels and got a big pop from their hometown fans. Of course, the fans in Cincinnati loved it. I think the Bengals are in first place in their division. What do you expect? If Impact came to New York and Eli Manning body slammed one of these guys, believe me, the fans would not be as kind. The Giants are 2-6. I guess winning really does cure all ills. Three-way to determine the number one contender to the Knockouts title with ODB, Velvet Sky, and Brooke Tessmacher. No winner after Gail Kim and Lady Tappa interfered for the DQ. A disqualification in a triple threat match. Don't look at me. I didn't book this shit. Gail got on the mic after the match and said that she has no competition left in TNA. Ain't that the truth? She issued an open challenge to any female outside the company to face her. If they can beat her, she'll even give them a shot at her Knockouts title. And if this is anything like Dixie's Pac-Man Jones surprise, it'll end up being fucking JWoww from Jersey Shore coming back to TNA and winning the championship. Personally, I'd love to see it be Awesome Kong, so she can come back and rekindle that feud she used to have with Gail Kim. Those two put the Knockouts division on the map back in the day, but I know Kong has no interest in ever going back to TNA. I can't say I blame her. We got a very NWO-esque message paid for by the friends of AJ Styles, which included footage of him defending his TNA title in AAA last weekend against Judas Macias. It's a clever way of getting that footage on the air. Otherwise, it really wouldn't have made much sense for them to air footage of a guy who quit the company and who they don't even recognize as their champion anymore. Styles is going to be defending the title again next Saturday in Great Muda's Wrestle 1 promotion in Japan, so they're doing what WWE failed to do with the Punk angle. They're having him defended in other promotions. I say good for them. That's one area where I think WWE makes a big mistake, is by not having some sort of working relationship with other promotions, whether it's Japan, Mexico, whatever. I know they want to be self-sufficient. They want to own everything. They don't play well with others. They don't even want to take indie guys anymore. They just want to create their own stars with the new Performance Center. Although I did hear they supposedly have interest in bringing in Prince Devitt, but he would be the exception. They've taken enough guys, WWE has, from ROH, for example. I don't know why they never had some sort of working agreement with them before ROH got TV, whether it's like a talent exchange or something like that. Once ROH got on TV, that was pretty much it. I don't see WWE working with anybody that has TV. Bully Ray. Bully Ray invaded Tommy Dreamer's House of Hardcore event last night at Poughkeepsie, New York. He attacked Dreamer and Terry Funk after the main event. He challenged Dreamer to a Falls Count Anywhere street fight. I guess TNA is having this old-school pay-per-view taping in the same building on December 30th. It's their first pay-per-view they're taping from New York. TNA posted footage of the attack on their YouTube channel as part of their 24/7 365 deal. I like that. I like the cross-promotion that we're seeing right now, whether it's AJ working in Mexico and Japan or this. I say thumbs up to TNA for trying something different here. It's fun for the fans. Garrett Bischoff and Nux talked backstage about Ken Anderson's message. Yes, I forgot to mention, Ken Anderson is on the show. He's opening the show, begging Dixie for a match against Bully. And she grants him a match, which is going to take place in 2 weeks on their Turning Point pay-per-view. It's one of those special, not really a pay-per-view, but we're pretending it is, editions of Impact. And he encountered Bischoff and Nux in an earlier backstage segment. He said, listen, I just want to tell you guys, it's great being on the outside. You're free. Life is better. Your food tastes better. He didn't say this, but it was almost like your food tastes better. The flowers smell better. You got to get out of this Aces and Eights BS. And so this is now what leads to this segment here. They're backstage. When Bully Ray walks up, Bully Ray says, hey, I heard you had a meeting with Mr. Anderson. And this all basically leads to there being a vote. Nux says, I don't care. We're going out to the ring, and we're having a vote on whether or not we keep this club together or not. So they have this big in-ring segment. Bully Ray is in there. Taz gets off headset. He comes into the ring. Garrett Bischoff goes first. He cuts this little speech. He says, I'm done. He takes off his vest. He's finished. He votes no more Aces and Eights. Now, think about the absurdity of this whole thing here, okay? They're having a vote. The vote is whether or not the group keeps going, right? Garrett Bischoff says, I don't want to be part of this group anymore. I vote to leave the group. So if the vote goes the other way, how does that work exactly? If I'm part of a group and I don't want to be part of this group anymore because it sucks, and I say, I'm leaving, and the rest of the vote happens and I'm outnumbered, and they vote, you know, 4-3 to keep the group intact, I'm supposed to stay part of the group anyway? I'm like, oh, damn, you know, I guess I can't leave the group. Only in wrestling. Could something so absurd make it to TV? Just the notion of this was so completely ridiculous to me. But whatever. He voted he was going to leave the group. Nux also said, I'm done. He took off his cut. And Bully said, well, you know, I at least know that Taz will vote the way that I'm going to vote, which means it's a tie vote, and a tie goes to the president. So that's his rationale. Taz says, actually, I'm out too. And he takes off his vest. He goes to hand it to Bully Ray, and there's this really tense moment where Bully Ray says, put your vest back on, and Taz says, make me. You know, shades of the old Taz, even though he looks like a giant butterball now. You know, he was showing some shades of the old Taz character here. In the middle of all this, Nux and Bischoff left. And Mr. Anderson, who had come out to watch the whole thing, Anderson is standing in the aisleway. Nux and Bischoff go to leave. Bully Ray turns to Anderson. He goes, this is all your fault. You're responsible for all of this happening. And he says, you know, you're such a big fan of Stone Cold Steve Austin, which is a shoot. I think Austin was one of the guys that stuck up for Anderson, you know, and kind of, I don't say take him under his wing, but he would give him advice, and Anderson would go to him for stuff. And here's Bully Ray saying, you know, you respect Stone Cold Steve Austin so much, and yet I can't believe you forgot Austin's very first rule. And at that point, Garrett Bischoff and Nux attack Ken Anderson from behind. The whole thing was a ruse, Aces and Eights. Not breaking up, not yet anyway. Actually, they are going to break up. I'll get to that in a second. This was all a big swerve. Now, ordinarily, I'd sit here and kind of make fun of TNA for, you know, another swerve. But I have to say, this was actually, for what it was, this was well done because I didn't see it coming. So at least they got me, even though I was very upset to see that, in fact, Aces and Eights was still together at the end of the segment. And Bully Ray says to Anderson, you know, if you're in the Aces and Eights, you'll never ride alone, you know, blah, blah, blah. Here's a minor spoiler for this Thursday show. So if you don't want to find out, it's a very minor spoiler. It's just about a stipulation. But if you don't want to hear it, skip ahead. They announced the stip of the Bully Mr. Anderson match at Turning Point in 2 weeks. If Anderson loses, he leaves TNA forever. But if Bully loses, Aces and Eights must disband for real this time. So I am hopeful that we are, in fact, seeing the end of this wretched group once and for all. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I will be rooting for Mr. Anderson. First time in my life, and probably the only time you'll ever hear me say that, I will be rooting for Mr. Anderson on November 21st. Ethan Carter III beat Dewey Barnes, the same jobber he beat 2 weeks ago. He won with the same implant DDT finisher. And he recited the same, I'm a Carter and the world needs us line after the match. Time to get this guy some new jobbers to play with. Maybe WWE can loan Dolph Ziggler over to them for a match or two. Bad Influence beat Eric Young and Joseph Park after Daniels threw his appletini in Park's face and Kazarian pinned him with the crucifix. It's just a completely nothing match. Kurt Angle came back out to challenge Bobby Roode yet again. Austin Aries came out instead. Austin Aries is going to be wrestling Kurt Angle next week in the TNA title tournament. Dixie showed up on the big screen and spun her Wheel of Dixie gimmick to decide the stipulation for their match, because every match in this tournament apparently needs a stipulation. It landed on submission match. Bobby Roode blew right past Austin Aries at that point. He came back down to the ring to fight Kurt Angle. Security had to break him up again. By this point, I think it was too much. People were like, okay, enough of this already. They had a hot opening segment that went long enough. I didn't need to see these guys brawl for half the show. What's worse is that after Impact, somebody in the back posted a photo on Twitter of Pac-Man Jones posing with Chris Daniels, Kazarian, Samoa Joe, Kurt Angle, and, yep, Bobby Roode. I mean, I know it's 2013 and kayfabe died a long time ago, but still, I had to sit through half the show watching these guys claw their eyes out, and they take a fucking picture together that ends up on Twitter after the show. It's just completely ridiculous. Jeff Hardy beat Chris Sabin in a Full Metal Mayhem match to advance to the TNA title tournament. I'm not going to recap everything they did. They did a bunch of spots with ladders and tables that you see in every one of these kinds of matches. Jeff Hardy took a few real bad bumps that made me just cringe. There was no reason for it. I didn't really enjoy this match. It was just a total spot fest. Nothing more, nothing less. Again, I hated that Hardy, the way he landed on some of those spots. You know, if that's your thing, cool. Maybe I've just seen one too many of these kind of matches this year. You know, Money in the Bank and a bunch of matches like this on TV. It really was just a lower rent version of Ultimate X that we just got done seeing at Bound for Glory. Hardy won with a swanton and got the pin, but man, did he take some abuse during this match. Not a fan of this. It was still the best match on the show, but that's not really saying much. The entire first half hour blew by without a single match. But, again, that didn't really bother me so much, just because I thought it was a really hot opening to the show. So I'm okay with that, but not a lot of wrestling on this show. Next week, Angle and Aries, submission match. It's a match I'm looking forward to. At least with the submission stipulation, I know they won't kill themselves. Well, I mean, Kurt might. At least that's the storyline they seem to be doing with him anyway, that the guy's going to kill himself in the ring one of these days. It's time for the mailbag. Monstrous mailbag here on episode 300. I tried to fit in as many questions. I got so many emails, I wanted to cry. I was up until 3 o'clock in the morning going through emails because they kept coming in, and I didn't want emails to overlap, so I had to go back and forth and check some of the questions I put in the mailbag earlier in the week. I just make one big list with the questions, and I was worried that they were overlapping. So if I didn't get to your question, I'm sorry. I did the best I could. We got two audio questions this week. And if you have audio questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster at gmail.com. Send them in MP3 format only. Try to keep them as brief as you can, and also put the text of your question in the body of your email. Our first audio question comes to us from John in Seattle.
Hi, Solmonster. This is John from Seattle. I just wanted to ask you, of all the 300 episodes you have done, what would you say was your best and worst episode? Oh, and I know I'm a bit late, but happy birthday, and congratulations on your 300th episode.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. My favorite episode of the Sound Off, yeah, I don't know if I have one favorite. I mean, episode 75 gets a lot of love. I mean, a lot of love from people who have gone back to listen to that Michael Jackson rant. You heard a little bit of it at the beginning of the show. So I guess that would be on my list. I mean, my personal favorites that I remember, I can't possibly remember every episode I ever did, but 129 stands out to me because my first interview that I did was with Tim Morrison, who played the ECW zombie on that first episode of WWE's ECW. I interviewed him on that show. That was fun. Episode 156... where I talked about TNA's appalling treatment of its talent, in particular the knockouts. There was a big expose done on the Cage Side Seats website, and it focused mostly on the women, their treatment of Daphne, and it was bad subject. I mean, it was a really awful thing to have to talk about, but I was happy to get into it, and there were a lot of people who had no idea. They didn't know about the Cage Side Seats story, and so to bring it to their attention and make them aware of what was going on at the time, that's one of those special shows. Episode 184 was cathartic for me. That was one of those emergency sound-offs I did the day after Raw because Raw was so awful. That was one of the worst episodes of Raw ever. Ever. I went back to listen to a little bit of that show. Boy, I have not sounded that angry on this show very often. I mean, I get pissed off about things, but that was a whole new level of pissed off on that episode. So that was fun. That was a good way to relieve a lot of stress. Episode 212 in Miami, the first roundtable sound-off I did with Noah Mark and Brian Blade. All the interviews that we did down in Miami with, I mean, the people we interviewed, it was unbelievable. We got to interview, you know, John Cena, one half of the WrestleMania main event, Shawn Michaels, Edge, who was going into the Hall of Fame, and he came walking over. We had no idea who we were talking to. You know, when we were made aware that we would be speaking with some WWE people early that morning, you know, you just assume it's going to be some mid-card talent, maybe some lower-card talent. You know, surely they're not going to make John Cena and Shawn Michaels wake up at 6:30 in the morning to do these interviews. And here comes Cena, here comes HBK, Edge comes over. We almost didn't even recognize him at first because that was when he debuted that new short haircut. So he came over, we joked around with him a little bit, and we talked to, you know, Daniel Bryan, who was the world heavyweight champion at the time, but, you know, certainly wasn't as big as he is now. One of the nicest guys you'll ever meet, Kofi Kingston, Kelly Kelly. I think her interview got cut. That was the one thing we didn't use, but we spoke to her. And the horsemen, the brainbusters, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard. Blanchard was out of the wrestling business for years and years, so here he comes walking over with Arn Anderson. I'm not even sure how much he even kept in touch with Arn, but they were back together that weekend, and they come walking over. They're sitting only a few feet in front of us. It was one of those experiences I'll never forget. And to be able to incorporate a lot of that audio into that episode of The Sound Off, that's probably my all-time favorite, was 212. 268 was the roundtable WrestleMania show we did earlier this year with Noah and Brian. That was a lot of fun. I can't remember them all, but those would be on my list. If I had to pick the worst one, maybe the first, you know, it was only 7 minutes long. You know how pissed off people would be if I did a 7 minute, 30 second sound off today? They'd burn me at the stake. So I'll say that. And if you want to listen to it, by the way, it's on my YouTube channel, the first episode. Our other audio question comes from someone you may know, Wyza, who does his own Raw review each week. You can find it at wyzanow.podbean.com. Let's hear what he has to say.
Hey, Solid Monster. This is Wyza. First of all, congratulations on the 300 episodes of the show in 6 years of longevity that you've been able to do this. This is a crazy milestone, and I just couldn't listen to such a milestone anniversary without hearing my own voice on it. The question I have for you is a fairly simple one, but I haven't really heard anybody touch it. Put yourself in Vince McMahon's shoes. We have a hot Ultimate Warrior and a hot Hulk Hogan, with Warrior winning the title, a title that seemed to be big at its time. With Warrior now penciled in as going to be the head of the company or the face of the company, and everything turning array at that point, how would you have handled the Ultimate Warrior debacle to see that Ultimate Warrior would have stayed the course and actually have been the face of the company for quite some time? Now I'm going to listen to the rest of the show. Peace.
Hogan vs. Warrior at WrestleMania 6. I still remember being so pissed off when Warrior won that match. I think he got exactly what he deserved. But no, I mean, what could Vince McMahon have done to make his run better, I guess, more successful, is basically the question. And the answer is that I don't think there was much more that he could do. I mean, the Warrior was booked very strongly. He rarely did a job. He was up in that Hogan stratosphere. It's not like the way they book champions today, especially if you have the World Heavyweight title. There was a stretch there where Del Rio couldn't win a match to save his life on TV, yet somehow he was retaining his title at all the pay-per-views. So back then, you know, Warrior was dominant. He'd go in there, he'd press slam guys, he'd splash him, he'd pin him, and he'd come out like a madman. He had that character, like he was full of energy. He was just this ball of energy. And you couldn't understand a word he said in any of his promos. He was completely psychotic. I don't really think there was anything Vince could have done himself. He gave him the platform. He put the rocket, right? He strapped it to his back. Hogan went away for a while. He gave him a shot. The only thing I could think of is maybe what Vince could have done is give him better opponents. But Warrior's first big opponent coming out of the WrestleMania match with Hogan was Rick Rude. Rick Rude was a great wrestler. And Rick Rude is the one who brought Warrior to one of the best matches I've seen Warrior have in WWE. which was that SummerSlam 89 rematch they had for the Intercontinental title where Warrior got the belt back. I never really thought much of their WrestleMania 5 match, but I thought that SummerSlam match in 89 was actually really, really good. Now, Savage still has the crown, for which is ironic since he was the Macho King at the time, but he still has the crown for giving Warrior his best match, WrestleMania 7, but the Loser Leaves Town match, but Rude was about as good of an opponent, I think, as Vince could have given him at the time. Rude made him look good. He could bump around for him. Rude obviously wasn't going to object to doing the job. So they had that cage match at SummerSlam, which was a big attraction. After that, you know, I mean, what more could the guy have done? Warrior just flamed out. He just wasn't very good. He was very one-dimensional. He was a one-trick pony. That's really what he was. That's why business started to suffer. Business certainly didn't rise. They thought maybe he would be the next big star after Hogan. It didn't work out that way. That's why they went back to Hogan. They had to get the title off Warrior, so they did the switch with Slaughter beating him at the Rumble. Warrior never got the belt back. Hogan got it back. And it's kind of like John Cena now. I feel like they give these guys a shot, and they panic. Oh, no, it's not working. We got to go back to the way things were. We got to go back to our sure bet. So in this case, they went back to Hogan, which was probably the best option for them because, again, they weren't happy with how business was going. Who else were they going to put the title on at the time? They didn't have guys like Bret Hart, you know, ready-made to run with the championship. So they went to their old stalwart, Hulk Hogan. Now, John Cena is kind of the same way. They give these guys a shot, Daniel Bryan, whoever, and if they don't perform right away, if ratings go down, if the next pay-per-view buy rate comes in and it's not great, oh, we gotta get the title off him, or we gotta move him down a peg and move somebody else. Let's get some big guys, like the Big Show, and move them into that spot instead. And I think that's completely fucked. I think that's stupid. They panic. In this case, though, they gave Warrior almost an entire year with the championship. I would hardly call it a panic move by moving the title back onto Hogan. I don't really think there was much Vince could have done. He gave him every opportunity to succeed. He did a little bit, but by no means did he meet expectations because he was one-dimensional. He came out, he shook the ropes, he press-slammed people, he grunted, he snorted. That's it. What more was there to the Ultimate Warrior character than that? Jay from Wisconsin, what got you into wrestling and what made you want to start your own podcast? I got into wrestling like a lot of people did. I was 4 years old and my father sat me in front of the TV because he and his father used to watch wrestling. They used to actually watch a lot of WCW Saturday Night on TBS. I never really cared for it. Now I love watching those old episodes, like when it comes up on Classics on Demand, whether it's WCW, WWF. But they were wrestling fans, and so I became a wrestling fan. I remember a lot of those early Saturday Night Main Event shows, Superstars, Wrestling Challenge, and it just kind of went from there. And I had a lot of friends who grew out of it, and I was one of those schmucks who never did. As far as starting the podcast, I mentioned this earlier. It was started as a way to just contribute something to SCScoops.com back when the Sound Off was part of that website, and it just grew from there. J.R. Sanders from straight out of Compton, California, writes in, first, how do you feel about WWE's locker room policy that any new wrestler has to shake every person's hand in the back or they will get automatic heat if they don't? I was of the impression that you shake everybody's hand whether you're new or not. I just think the whole thing is silly, but maybe to them it builds camaraderie or something. Second question he has, I've heard the term X-Pac heat get floated around for many years, but don't understand why it's called X-Pac heat. Do you know how or why that term came to existence? To be fair, I got the same question from another one of our loyal listeners, Matt, so I just want to give him credit here for the question as well on this 300th show. I don't know who started it, but it's basically a form of go-away heat, as in, we don't want to see you, get off my TV. X-Pac was really over during the DX days, and even afterwards when he did the tag team thing with Kane. Kane and X-Pac was, they were a cool team, I thought. I like Kane and X-Pac together. So what happened is it got started when that ended and X-Pac turned heel. He just never really, he never really evolved from that character. Everybody else kind of moved on. Triple H moved on, he went corporate. But X-Pac, he pretty much stayed the same. He grew to be a little bit whiny. If I recall, he did the X-Factor thing. Remember that little X-Factor faction with Justin Credible and Tenzai? And that was a flop. Oh, God, that Uncle Cracker song. That alone would be enough to give anybody go-away heat. Maybe that's what did it. I don't really know. But that's pretty much how and why it all came about. People just largely grew apathetic towards the guy. They just didn't care. Benjamin writes in, what were your thoughts on Jake Roberts saying that he wants to promote an Indiegogo campaign so he can raise money to buy a share of TNA? because he thinks they suck, and he wants to make their show a wrestling show, not a sports entertainment one. I think Jake the Snake should be very happy that people contributed to an Indiegogo campaign to help him repair his shoulder, and I think that people's money also contributed to him getting new teeth, and he got new hair. Look, I don't want to say he definitely took advantage of the money people gave him. He made sure it went to a lot of different things, and I think he ought to be grateful for that. I'm getting a little sick and tired of everybody going on Indiegogo and Kickstarter and GoFundMe and Go Fuck Yourself and all these different services begging people for money. You know, in the case of Jake, it was a nice thing. They put the video up. We all know Jake's fallen on hard times. You know what I mean? That doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And he had the bum shoulder, and everybody thought, you know what, this guy might be able to get his life back on track. He just wants to be able to keep doing the DDP yoga. It's become such an important part of his, you know, his everyday life. Nobody wants to see Jake fall off the wagon and go back to his worrisome ways. So they contributed, and they contributed, boy, I mean, they went well beyond the goal. I think the goal was like 80 grand. He ended up raising over 100. It was something crazy like that. And that was a really feel-good thing, okay? There are exceptions to the rule. Zema Ion, who had those medical bills that TNA was unwilling to pay, he went, and actually he didn't go, his girlfriend did, and started this online campaign to raise money. I don't think they met their goal. So there are certain situations, but now it just, I don't know, every other day I hear about somebody going on Indiegogo and, you know, begging people to raise money for this, raise money for that, and there's just something about it now that rubs me a little bit the wrong way. If you want to show your support, if you want to contribute to a worthy cause, even if there is, so like Hacksaw Jim Duggan just posted a pretty emotional video where he's got a torn rotator cuff. He showed he can't really lift his arm. And Duggan still works indie shots every weekend. The guy's 60 years old. He still has to support his family, right? He doesn't have a pension. He doesn't have a retirement fund or a 401k. He's got to go out there and work. And, you know, it was really in a very heartfelt, emotional video. It can't be easy for guys like this, these old school, tough, rugged guys, to go and basically beg for money on the internet. So in a situation like that, that's fine. And Duggan met his goal, by the way. So he's going to get the surgery, which is good to hear. This rubs me the wrong way just in that, okay, I want the fans to help me raise money so that I can buy a share of TNA. No, that's not what these Indiegogo campaigns should be for. So that you can go and buy a share of some wrestling company, you know, this pie in the sky thing, and go run it. Maybe he was tongue-in-cheek, maybe he was serious. I'm just going by Benjamin's email here, but if he was serious, there's something about that would piss me off. It's like, you know what, you raise money for yourself, you got your life back in order, that's really cool. Stop bumming money off people. There's a lot of worthy causes out there. I wouldn't consider that exactly a worthy cause. Benjamin also wrote in, he said, you mentioned a list of wrestlers that have been the guy in their respective era, but you failed to mention a guy that arguably deserves to be recognized with those greats as well, Bob Backlund. Do you agree with this? And if not, why? Yeah, Backlund had a lot of success. Backlund was WWF champion for like 5.5 years. When the Bruno era ended and Billy Graham had less than a year run with the championship, Backlund won the title from him, and Backlund became the de facto big baby face, at least in the Northeast. I don't think Backlund drew well outside the Northeast. He had his cities, probably New York, Philly, where he was very strong. I don't think Backlund was ever really the draw that like Bruno was, but absolutely. I mean, Backlund had a lot of success. I wasn't a fan in that era. I wasn't even alive at the beginning of the era when Backlund first won the title, so I can't really relate to whether or not people looked at Backlund as the guy the way they looked at Bruno as the guy. And Bruno was on top at one point with the title for 8 years. So that's even longer than Backlund. Backlund does get a little lost in the shuffle. I think he deserves recognition, but I don't know that Backlund was ever the guy in the same way Bruno was, and that, God forbid, if something would have happened to Bruno when he was on top at his peak with the title, I think it would have been catastrophic for the old WWF. If the same thing happened to Backlund, I don't know. Maybe people who were around during that era feel differently about it. I don't know that they would have crumbled the way that they might have crumbled if somebody like Bruno or Hogan during his era, as important as he was to the company, if they would have lost Hogan, that would have been a huge, huge blow to the company. I don't know if you could say the same thing for Backlund. That's the one reason I think people don't necessarily put him in the same category. But does he deserve recognition? Absolutely. Yovan from Melbourne, Australia. What is your opinion on the mentality of the stereotypical smark or internet wrestling fan? I recall looking at old Google group archives of old wrestling forums in which fans were complaining even in 1999 over Stone Cold being shoved down their throat and The Rock being repetitive. Things have not changed, as those same whims are still prevalent today. Do smark fans hate the status quo? Do they hate happiness? Hopefully we can get Christopher Nowinski to study their brains after they die. You know what? Hey, Austin was being shoved down people's throats. The Rock did get repetitive after a while. I think those were valid claims. But I think also, when you get that groupthink, like before the internet, you didn't have the ability to just log on and have this giant discussion with a bunch of like-minded people. You had your friends, maybe your family, and that's it. When the internet came along, and I think this goes for anything, this goes not just for wrestling, but a lot of other things in pop culture and in life and entertainment and all that. When you have this massive open forum like this, it's a lot easier for people to just bitch and moan. And believe me, there are plenty of wrestling fans who bitch and moan. I bitch and moan too. I just like to think that when I bitch and moan, I try to back it up with why. I don't just bitch and moan for the sake of doing it, because it's the cool thing to do. I don't just shit on things for the hell of it. But I think that there is a lot of that in wrestling. I think there are some fans, quite frankly, who they get off on complaining. I don't think they hate happiness. I just think they're really, really happy when they can bitch about something and they see that other people agree with them and they bitch about the same things. And if something happens, the first inclination is, okay, well, what's wrong with this? How can we criticize this? Even if it's something great. It's like a great character. It's a great match. It's a great angle. You know, like TNA, I gave them credit earlier in the show for the Aces and Eights swerve on Impact, and I never thought I would praise anything Aces and Eights related, but kudos to TNA. They got me on Thursday, I admit it. But I think a lot of other people wouldn't do that, and they would look at it and they would pick it apart, even if there really is no good reason to pick it apart. So, you know, hopefully that answers your question. I just think when you have that sort of groupthink, like I said. You know, I heard this quote once, and I love it, and it's so true. A person is very smart. People are dangerous and stupid. And that goes for, you know, flash mobs and all that kind of stuff. A person on their own is actually very intelligent, but when you get a group of people together, they can do and say some really stupid shit. And I think you get that a lot with wrestling fans. Dave from Malaysia. Since WWE doesn't seem to care much for the World Heavyweight Championship, do you think it should be officially demoted to mid-card status? I thought it already was. Demoted to mid-card status and contested only for the heavyweight wrestlers, then create lightweight and middleweight championships for wrestlers in those divisions, respectively, and deactivate the Intercontinental and U.S. titles. Let the WWE title be the sole main championship in the company, contested only by current or former holders of the aforementioned weight divisions. Give some exceptions to Royal Rumble winners and Money in the Bank briefcase holders, as those who can directly challenge for the title without meeting those other qualifications. And maybe bring back King of the Ring and let the winner have that privilege as well. I seriously doubt WWE would adopt this set of rules because even I admit it's a bit too complicated and restrictive. Would you do it if you were in charge? No. And partly because I am a little confused in going back and listening to the question. I like the idea of making things more serious. You mentioned weight divisions. Okay, one idea that I've pitched for the longest time, and I don't know why they do it, or why they don't do it. TNA tried to do it, and they completely fucked it up. So it was a good idea in theory, and they didn't know how to execute it. But in WWE, they should have, like, power rankings. I think there should be rankings, top 5, top 10, for the major championships. So basically, you have a top 10 ranking for the WWE championship, and I guess the world title, although I wish they would do away with that. So let's say they do away with it, because I would just get rid of the title. I would merge them. You have a top 10 list of contenders for the WWE Championship, and you try to stay true to that list as much as possible. You get people interested in it, too. People like numbers. They like stats. They like rankings, you know, whether it's fantasy sports, football, basketball. I think the same can be said for wrestling. So you update those rankings every week. You post them on .com. You post them in the app. People can follow along. And on TV, look, if you want a guy who's number 7 in contention for the title to move up the list, you've got an angle in mind for him, you could have a match on Raw one week where the number 3 seed and the number 7 seed have a match, and if number 7 wins, they switch places or something like that. It doesn't have to be this hard and fast thing where, oh, well, this guy's number 8 out of 10, and so he's never going to get a title shot. It's so boring and predictable. It's the same people. You can manipulate it any way you want to, but have some sort of ranking system that people can take seriously, that people can track on their own. Top 10 for the world title, and do a top 5 for every other title in the company. Top 5 intercontinental contenders, top 5 U.S. title, top 5 tag teams, because they don't have 10 tag teams they could put on a list anyway. I think that's a much better way to go. If you had a cruiserweight championship, then sure, you have a weight limit. But I think heavyweight, middleweight, lightweight, that sounds too MMA-ish. You know, that's fine for UFC. I don't think that's going to work in wrestling. Sam writes in, "If just started listening to your show and loving every minute. Got back into watching wrestling a few months ago, and so far so good. But one thing that keeps me face-palming every time is when Great Khali is in the ring. The guy can hardly move. He no-sells everything and has his two moves of doom, the Khali chop and putting people in the corner and slapping their chest. Do you think it's time for Khali to move on?" I think it was time for Khali to move on the day he made his debut. He's never really been that good. But they have this renewed focus now on the bigger guys, which is why I guess we're seeing Big Show on TV. Khali even is being more featured, prominently more featured on TV now than he was even a few months ago. So there's that. He's larger than life, so they love that about the guy. He's, you know, if you see him walking through an airport, you're more likely to notice the Great Khali than you are Daniel Bryan, which is true. I don't really think that means much, but it is true. But I think part of it also is, you know, you listen to some of these guys talk about Khali. They've done interviews and stuff, and everyone seems to love Khali. He seems like a nice guy. They all seem to love him, I guess, backstage, and they're very friendly with him. He's very well-liked. And I wonder, you know, if part of it also is they realize that the guy doesn't have that much time left. I mean, I hate to say it, but I don't see the Great Khali, you know, walking around either with a cane or whatever at the age of 60. There's guys that are Khali's size who don't live very long. You know, they kind of made that the storyline on Raw with the Big Show. And God forbid, hopefully the Big Show lives a long, normal life. You know, the condition Big Show had, he had that corrected when he was in high school, I think. So the hope with Big Show is that he won't be like Andre, even though he's a big guy, that he'll be able to live a lot longer. Khali, I don't think, you know, Khali had the same condition. Khali had an operation. I think it was a tumor on his pituitary. He actually had surgery for it either last year or earlier this year. But Khali is an older guy at this point. So you wonder, you know, is it really going to make that much of a difference? I hope the guy lives a long life, but maybe they look at it and they say, look, this guy is not going to have the sort of longevity that a lot of wrestlers would. He's a really good guy, very well liked. Let's just get him on TV. You know, he can keep making as much money as he can make in the meantime until he absolutely can't do this anymore. I'm with you, though. I watch him, and it's painful. It's painful to watch him walk to the ring, that funny way he walks, his knees and everything else. I don't know what he feels like from day to day, if he's in constant pain or what the deal is with Khali, but it's painful to watch, and it's painful to watch his matches because he sucks as a wrestler. But Khali is not the kind of person you expect to go in there and have 4-star matches and do flips off the top rope. He serves a certain purpose, and you know, we'll probably see him on TV until he absolutely just can't do it anymore. I think it's just them really throwing the guy a bone and letting him make a ton of money until he just can't do it anymore. This question comes from Dominic. My question stems from Daniel Bryan being out of the WWE title picture because of the SummerSlam buy rate and the fact that he's too average. First, I can't see how they gave him a chance at all to begin with, because they just undermined him and basically made him look like a loser. I'm frustrated, angry, and disappointed. My question isn't so much about his lack of push, but more of fan response. All I see online are threads bashing Vince McMahon. At the end of the day, I have yet to hear or see any wrestling fans really do anything proactive about a particular issue. I hear people saying they should just stop buying pay-per-views, but what does that really do to speak about the volume of people who are outright pissed? I've seen people with signs about Ziggler equals ratings and people spamming on Twitter, but what do you think fans could or should do in order to take a stand against WWE? Granted, fans don't dictate everything, but I just want to see someone do something that'll really make an impact on situations like this where Bryan is downgraded, which is totally unfair. That, and we bought awesome seats to Raw in Seattle, and suddenly the storyline went from being super intriguing to something of a yawn fest. It's really simple, okay? I'm going to give you a really simple answer about what fans can do if that's the way they honestly feel. Stop supporting the product. That's it. If people in mass stopped watching the shows, okay? No Raw, no SmackDown, nothing. Stop buying the pay-per-views. Stop getting things to trend on Twitter. Because you know for a fact that if they weren't trending on Twitter, that's one way to get their attention. Don't download the app. Don't buy any merchandise on WWE Shop. That's the way to do it. If you really feel that strongly about it, you need other people who feel the same way. And you just have to stop giving them what they want. You got to hit them where it hurts. Hit them in their bank account. And on social media, which they love oh so much. But if there's one thing, whether it's Daniel Bryan getting screwed over or whatever, and that many people are that pissed off about it, if somehow all of these people can band together and do this, that's the best way, I think, that you can get their attention. And that's never, ever, ever going to happen. You'll never be able, I don't think, to get that many people together at once to do that. And that's why WWE will never listen. They will continue to do what they want, when they want. They know better than you do. They know what we want better than we do. That's the attitude. That will never change. But that would be the only way. Colt Herrera writes in, when is the last time any up-and-comer that wasn't on their way to getting over, or already over, such as CM Punk or Daniel Bryan, benefited from working a program with John Cena? I think that one of the main gripes I have with Cena is his lack of being a true ring general. I feel one of the most important things in being a said ring general is the ability to make your opponents look good at the risk of looking vulnerable, and the ability to take somebody who the fans maybe never perceived as credible and make something of them. For example, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Ric Flair, most of all, Mick Foley. Look at the list of guys that could have benefited from working with Cena and whose careers have effectively stalled. Wade Barrett, The Miz, Zack Ryder, Ryback, and Dolph Ziggler. It seems that after working with Cena, any type of momentum or heat they had fizzled, and they go back down lower than where they were when they first started. Fair point. I'm going to play devil's advocate here. First of all, that's not really what a ring general is. My understanding is that a ring general is someone who can lead in the ring during a match. They can feel the crowd and, you know, improvise if need be and get cues from the back, maybe from the referee, and pass it along. And just generally keep things from falling apart. Has nothing to do with putting guys over. So you may have your terms mixed up there. Second, about John Cena. I'm going to defend John Cena because I think John Cena has done a hell of a lot more than a lot of main eventers in that company's history to help get other guys, newer guys, over in a main event position. The fact that in a lot of those cases it hasn't happened, you want to point to Wade Barrett, you want to point to Dolph Ziggler, fair point, I'm with you. Don't blame John Cena. Blame Vince McMahon. Okay, that's where the blame lies. Cena, look at Cena's body of work. Cena put over Rob Van Dam when somebody like Triple H would not. It wasn't Cena's fault that Van Dam got busted by the cops and he embarrassed the company. That's on Van Dam. The Miz was booked to look like a fool. He was a warm body to stick in there with John Cena at WrestleMania so The Rock could get involved and could leave Cena laying. They basically booked WrestleMania 27 just to set up WrestleMania 28. Blame WWE, not John Cena. Cena put over CM Punk clean, pretty much, at Money in the Bank, which helped propel him to main event status. Triple H did his damnedest to ruin that, but Punk got over anyway. Cena put over Daniel Bryan, clean as a sheet, at SummerSlam. Is it his fault that WWE botched the follow-up so badly? How do you think he felt sitting at home watching that? He doesn't do very many clean jobs in pay-per-view main events. You don't just squander something like that. How do you think he must feel? Probably not too good. Ryback. By the time Ryback got to John Cena, he was already dead. That wasn't John Cena's fault. Barrett and Ziggler, like I said, I don't have a good answer for you. It's a fair point. Zack Ryder, I don't know why you would throw Zack Ryder in there. Zack Ryder was booked at every turn to look like a goof. Even when he was getting something of a push, they gave him the U.S. title. He was always, always, always booked to look like a goof. He was never main event material. I don't blame WWE or John Cena for the fact that Zack Ryder didn't get over as a main eventer. You know why Zack Ryder didn't get over as a main eventer? Because he's not a main eventer. That's why. Yes, it was really stupid for them to book Zack Ryder as like John Cena's best friend, and yet Zack Ryder would get killed by Kane every single week. See, it's like Cena was like the worst friend in the world. But that was the storyline. I don't think John Cena went out of his way to say, hey, you know, how can I make Zack Ryder look like an asshole on the show this week? Blame the writers. Blame Vince. They're the idiots who came up with this shit. Look at the guys John Cena has worked with as compared to Hulk Hogan when he was on top. As compared to The Warrior, who we talked about earlier, when he was on top. When Shawn Michaels was the man in WWE. All these different guys over the years. All these main eventers from over the years. Stone Cold Steve Austin. Okay? All of them. John Cena gave more in these matches with these younger guys and these newer guys who they were trying to push than any of those guys ever did when they were on top with the title. So I think to criticize John Cena for it is ridiculous. It may come off that way on TV, but it's not his fault. It's Vince McMahon's fault. Adam M. writes in, I'm a newer fan of the Sound Off, been following since the mid-280s. I've been going back and listening to past Sound Off. So far, my favorite is your Macho Man tribute. One question I have does relate to Randy Savage. Do you think WWE should give in to his request of the Poffo family, Randy, Lanny, and Angelo, being inducted into the Hall of Fame, just to get Randy in? Lanny Poffo has said this is what Randy wants many times. I know doing this could set WWE up for more Hall of Fame holdouts, but I think doing it this one time is worth it. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's ridiculous to have a Hall of Fame and for somebody like Randy Savage not to be in there. We said the same thing about Bruno. They finally put Bruno in. It's time to do the right thing and put Randy Savage in there. And I know Lanny Poffo has gone around saying, hey, if they want to put Savage in, go ahead, but we won't have any part of this. And that would suck because there would be this shadow cast over it, knowing that the family isn't there and it's against the family's wishes. They could do whatever they want. I would just put them in. Who cares at this point? You can make a case for Angelo Poffo being in the Hall of Fame. Lanny Poffo, it's a little bit harder, but they've got guys like Nikolai Volkoff and James Dudley and, I mean, other names that don't have any business being in a real legit Hall of Fame. So once you start putting guys like that in there, all bets are off. If that's what it takes to get Randy Savage in the Hall of Fame, then go ahead and do it. It doesn't matter because he should be in there, but it's not going to be the same. They waited too long. He's dead. It's not going to be the same without him being there. But if that's what it takes to get the guy in, then yes, I agree. Put the whole family in. They put the Von Erichs in, none of whom, aside from Kerry, I don't think, ever even worked for WWE. Most of those kids were very, very young when they died. They did nothing in wrestling in some cases, yet they put the whole family in. So you know what? If you could put the Von Erichs in, then there's no reason not to put the Poffo family in. His second question is, what are your thoughts of Jim Cornette as a manager slash booker slash personality? And have you ever checked out his old podcast, Cornette's Commentary? I've not checked out his old podcast, but I think Jim Cornette is one of the best managers in the history of wrestling. Not the best. I think number one is always Bobby Heenan. He's at the top of my list whenever somebody asks me. Heenan was number one, and even number two. Number two, I think, I waffle back and forth between Paul Heyman and Jim Cornette, because both of them are very, very good at what they do, but the number one spot is Bobby Heenan. But Heenan is Cornette is a manager. I thought he was really good. As a booker, he obviously had some success with Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Not so much with Ring of Honor, so it's not as though he has this perfect sterling record as a booker. And Smoky Mountain, you know, if Smoky Mountain was so successful, they wouldn't have gone out of business when they did. But he had some success there, and, you know, even on commentary, he would sometimes do announcing for WWF during the Attitude Era. He would fill in when Lawler wasn't there, and I didn't think he was bad. So I like Cornette. Abdulaziz wants to know, where is Evan Bourne? Also, why did Ric Flair leave the WWF with all the momentum he had after winning the 1992 Royal Rumble and becoming WWF champion? Evan Bourne, I just heard something where Evan Bourne is, I think, going to be back in a few weeks. I think Evan Bourne is scheduled to return to the road within the next month or so. That doesn't mean he'll be on TV, but it looks like Evan Bourne might finally be coming back. Look, Evan Bourne's a really talented guy. I just wonder why they've kept him around. It just makes me, I mean, he's a talented guy, but I think he would always get fined for, like, pot violations. He may have actually gotten suspended once by the wellness policy. He's a small guy. Now they're back into bigger guys again. He's been out for so long. It just makes me wonder why they've even kept him around. Other guys, they would have probably dropped him like a rock. They must really see something in this guy to keep him around for that long. And as far as the Flair question is concerned, Flair had a lot of momentum at the beginning of the year, but he lost the title of WrestleMania. He didn't even wrestle at SummerSlam that year. He was on the card, but he didn't actually have a match. He won the title back. They wanted to get the title off him, though, the whole steroid thing. They wanted a new, clean-cut, younger guy, so they put the belt on Bret. At that point, they really weren't doing anything with Flair. Flair was in the Survivor Series match. It was him and Razor Ramon against Savage and Perfect. After that, he clearly was moved out of the main event. And my understanding is that he had a handshake agreement, I don't think it was anything in writing, with Vince McMahon, where if Vince ever moved him out of the main event picture, he would let Flair, if Flair wanted, go back to WCW, which was his home for so many years. And Vince agreed to that, and when Flair saw the writing on the wall that he essentially had been demoted and was not going to be in the title picture, he was not going to be in the main event scene, he went to Vince and said, I want to leave. And he had Flair finish up his international commitments. He did the Loser Leaves Town match on Raw with Kurt Hennig and lost. And Vince let him go with some provisions because Flair couldn't exactly go back to WCW and wrestle right away, which is why Flair came up with this a Flair for the Gold interview segment when he came back. Flair didn't actually wrestle until much, much later in the year. So Vince let him go, but with some caveats. But that's why he left. He was out of the main event picture, and he had an agreement with Vince that if that happened, he would let him go. And Vince did. Chad asks, do you think if Shane McMahon ran WWE, that storylines would be more logically booked than they are currently? I always felt that Shane was the most even-keeled and down-to-earth member of the McMahon family, so he wouldn't be as inclined to hold petty grudges, which can often derail storylines. We never saw Shane booked, so who really knows? You can be a nice guy with shitty ideas. I think I remember reading once that Shane had come up, he had some creative input into something at one point, and it wasn't pretty. But I agree, I always liked Shane. He was the one member of that family I could tolerate, even after the rest of them were overexposed. You know, the one guy I didn't really mind seeing on TV, and instead were left with the other two. The wrestling gods have a wicked sense of humor. Eric Garcia from Providence, Rhode Island, if you were a pro wrestler yourself, what would your ring name be, your finisher, your entrance music, and would you be a babyface or a heel? Well, I think the Solomonster name was tailor-made for a wrestling gimmick, so I'd go with that, even though they'd never let me use it. They'd probably call me fucking Nathan Picklepepper or some shit like that. Entrance music would be... I'm really into this song DLZ by TV on the Radio. I think for a heel especially, that'd be a cool song. Finisher would be Bob Backlund's old crossface chicken wing. I used to love using that move on my little brother. God, that was so much fun. And I would prefer to be a heel, especially with the song. It's a lot easier and probably more fun to get people to hate you than it is to get them to like you. And finally, Johnny from London writes in, the last time you read a question of mine on the air, I asked what you would say to somebody thinking of stopping watching wrestling because they'd become simply too disillusioned with the product. Since then, I have indeed stopped watching. Well, I guess my advice didn't work. And he says, I rely heavily on your podcast and the internet to keep up to date with the world of wrestling. I occasionally watch TNA because it is readily available on free TV in the UK, but it's more for convenience. I certainly don't go out of my way to find WWE. So my question is this. Over the past 6 years, we have heard you rant and rave about pro wrestling. So very simply, what is it that keeps you coming back? Why do you put up with all the crap week in and week out? And what is it that you are hooked on? I ask because I'm sure there are many listeners in my situation who would appreciate some inspiration to get them back to watching on a regular basis again. Well, the biggest reason I keep watching is because I do this podcast. I don't think people would be very happy if I stopped watching wrestling because I'd have to stop doing the show. I enjoy doing the show, actually like doing it, preparing for it, and getting your feedback more than I do watching wrestling half the time. So that's number one. But you know what? There's been so many periods of wrestling over the years that have been really, really bad. Very boring, lots of gimmicks, shitty characters, same people over and over again, just bad creative, you name it. We've had a lot of periods like that, and some people would say we're in the middle of one right now. This is not a great time to be a wrestling fan. I wouldn't say it's the worst time to be a wrestling fan, by no means. There's a lot of good things that you could pick out from wrestling right now, and if I had to give advice to somebody who was going to stop watching or already did stop watching, I would say this. What is it exactly that you expect to get out of watching wrestling? Why do you watch pro wrestling? Ask yourself that question. I think there's a lot of people who watch and they don't even know. They just watch it out of habit. Like me, I've been watching since I was 4 years old. So for me, part of it is I've just been doing it for so long. I can't imagine just completely not watching it at all and just moving on to something else. Yeah, I'm a baseball fan. I have a few other hobbies, but nothing to the degree of wrestling. How would I fill that void in my life without this bullshit? You know what I mean? It's like when your favorite TV show goes off the air. I just got done watching Breaking Bad. I steamrolled through 5 seasons, I guess technically 6 seasons of Breaking Bad in 3 weeks. I don't know why I never watched the show. I always heard good things about it. I finally watched it, and I just binge-watched. And it's one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. If it's not the best show of all time, it's number 2. Okay, that's how highly I think of it. Now, if I had been watching Breaking Bad with everybody else year after year, live in real time instead of binge-watching, I'd probably be more upset than I am when the show ended, because it's been a part of your life for so long that when something like that comes to an end and you just stop, it's like, what am I going to do now? You know, how am I going to fill that void? I don't watch a lot of TV. Wrestling is probably the bulk of what I watch on TV. So I think that's part of it. I think people just watch it out of habit. Oh, wrestling on Monday night, it's the thing to do. But you watch it, and half the time, it's like, why do I even watch this shit? This was boring. This sucked, or whatever. Like Raw this week, I didn't think Raw was any good at all this week. It had its moments, but I thought the whole theme of the show sucked. I am not into this Big Show Randy Orton bullshit. Does that mean I should just stop watching wrestling? Well, I mean, there's some things in TNA that I enjoy, for as fucked as that company is. In WWE, there's a lot of newer guys, younger guys, The Shield. I thoroughly enjoy The Shield's matches. I think Cody and Goldust in particular, has been a huge bright spot since he came back. That's a great story to follow. NXT. There are weeks when I enjoy watching NXT more than Raw. I enjoy some of the younger guys, the gimmicks, Tyler Breeze, you know, Aiden English, Sami Zayn. I think the future looks bright. If these guys ever get a shot, Paige and Emma, as far as the Divas, who for the most part they treat like shit. But if they ever got their act together and they put together a real Divas division, I think it could be a lot of fun. So I think the key is that there's always hope. You always hope it's going to get better, right? God, wrestling sucks right now. Man, I hope it's going to get better. I can't wait. You know, WrestleMania is coming up. Maybe they'll bring in Sting. Maybe they'll bring back Goldberg. Maybe, you know, who's The Undertaker going to face? All these questions pop up so that no matter how boring you may think things are, it's like, well, in a few months it'll pick up. And maybe it will, maybe it won't. But I think habit and hope, the two H's, those are the two reasons why people keep watching wrestling who are on the fence about why they watch. Habit and hope. That's what it is. The best advice I could give is just stay the course. If wrestling isn't that important to you, then move on. There's no sense in being pissed off about something. I have to do it just because I can't stop watching. And I do this show. I've made that commitment. Whether it's a good week of wrestling TV or a bad week. You know what? When wrestling is bad, sometimes it tends to make for more entertaining sound-offs because I'll just go off on a rant and people love it. For me, it's worth it to sit through all the BS and all the bad stuff when they have, you know, a big name come back and their music hits and they get a big pop and the crowd's going crazy. Like, a hot crowd can be really infectious and can make things seem hotter than they are. You get a couple of Raws with, like, really hot crowds, and it's amazing how your perception can change. But for me, I live for those moments. I live for the big comeback and, you know, the glass shatters or whatever and the people go crazy, or they really hit on a match that I want to see, like they did at SummerSlam. I was genuinely excited to see, you know, Cena and Bryan. It's not just for Bryan's sake, but just two baby faces in the main event. You don't really see that too often. That was a match that actually intrigued me and got me excited. And the crowd that night in the building in LA was going nuts. When they did the Money in the Bank swerve at the end of the show, say what you want to about Daniel Bryan getting screwed, his big moment. I thought that was so well done, and the crowd reaction to it was perfect. It was exciting. So moments like that, for me, make it worth watching wrestling, even if you think that right now wrestling isn't all that great. And if those moments don't get you excited, then maybe it's time to move on. History has been made here! This week, in wrestling history, we go back 28 years ago this week on November 7, 1985. WWE held its first pay-per-view event, its first full pay-per-view called the Wrestling Classic. First WrestleMania earlier that year was largely a closed-circuit TV event, as many of the big events back then were in boxing and pro wrestling. This would ultimately pave the way for the pay-per-view revolution in wrestling, which brought in lots of money. But as we see these days, the market is just so saturated and technology is changing so rapidly. The ways these pay-per-views are treated now is very different. I don't think pay-per-view is a dying industry, even with the piracy that goes on and people streaming and all that. Just because, look at the biggest boxing shows and the biggest UFC shows. They still pull over 1 million buys. WWE's pay-per-view business is in the shitter because they no longer know how to do pay-per-view. They apparently forgot. Show was built around a one-night-only tournament that built to Junkyard Dog beating Randy Savage in the finals by count-out. Talk about an ultra-lame finish. Savage was impressive, though. He beat Ivan Putski, Ricky Steamboat, and the Dynamite Kid before losing in the final round. Hulk Hogan beat Roddy Piper by DQ in the main event when Cowboy Bob Orton interfered. 25 years ago this week, on November 4th, 1988, John Carpenter's cult classic film They Live, starring Rowdy Roddy Piper, was released in theaters across the country. It opened at number one that weekend.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
The movie grossed nearly $5 million over its first 3 days. If a film now had a $5 million opening weekend, unless it was an art house film or something, it'd be considered a bomb. I looked it up. Ready to Rumble, one of the sorriest excuses for a movie I've ever seen, actually did slightly over $5 million for its opening weekend, but I can at least take solace in the fact that They Live ended up taking in more money overall than Ready to Rumble did, about $1 million more. Ready to Rumble is also considered by some to be a cult classic, but that can't be right. If that's the case, they must mean it's only a hit amongst members of actual cults. At least I hope that's what they mean. In the film, Piper plays a drifter who discovers a special pair of sunglasses that allows him to distinguish human beings from aliens, and he quickly realizes that aliens are taking over the planet. They conceal their identities, they blend in as humans, they walk among us, sending subliminal messages through the media. The movie features what may be the all-time greatest fight scene, certainly one of the longest, a 5-minute-plus fist fight scene in an alley between Roddy Piper and actor Keith David, who was awesome in the movie The Thing, which is another Carpenter film from the 80s that I love. Big John Carpenter fan here, you can tell. Actually, Piper and Keith David recreated their fight scene in the Saints Row 4 video game that came out earlier this year. You can YouTube it and find videos of their scene on there. They did the voiceovers for it and everything. This is not a movie that is kind to society's ruling class, I guess you would say, the political establishment, the rich. I think Carpenter was attempting to make some sort of political statement here, basically telling people, open your eyes to what's going on around you. You know, all of the obey stuff in the movie, Piper would put on the glasses and see these subliminal messages saying, obey, obey. And an interesting little fact I had not been aware of, apparently the movie, after opening at number one, pretty much went missing from theaters 2 weeks later. It disappeared. Keith David did an interview a while back where he said you couldn't find the movie after 2 weeks, even if you wanted to. He asked John Carpenter about that, and all Carpenter would say to him was, I think we may have pissed somebody off. And given the film's subject matter, maybe it's not all that surprising. He did say he made the film as a way to give the finger to Ronald Reagan, who was president at the time, so who knows, maybe that had something to do with it. 16 years ago this week, on November 9th, 1997, the infamous Montreal Screwjob. Do I even have to explain what happened here? I'll give the condensed version. Bret Hart was the WWF champion. He was leaving for WCW. He also did not like Shawn Michaels, who he would be wrestling at Survivor Series. It was their first singles match in 18 months. He had a clause in his contract that said his final 30 days, in that period, he had full creative control. And he met with Vince McMahon backstage at the Molson Center that night. He discussed a whole bunch of possible finishes. Bret offered to do a DQ and hand over the title on Raw the next night, make a nice little speech, and go on his merry way. Vince said fine, even though a plan had already been hatched to screw Bret out of the championship, so Eric Bischoff could not go on Nitro the next night and tell the world that he just signed the WWF champion. Vader even pulled Bret Hart aside before the match backstage, and he warned him about a possible screw job. He told him not to allow himself in any submission holds. Bret said, it's all good. I talked to Earl Hebner, the referee. He said he won't screw me. He swore on his kids' lives that he would not screw me. And Earl Hebner then proceeded to help screw Bret, calling for the bell when Bret allowed Shawn Michaels to put him in the sharpshooter. Hebner, who had taken a bump, was supposed to stay down, and Bret was supposed to reverse the hold on Shawn, which he did anyway. But the match was already over at that point. Sean acted all angry. He pretended like he didn't know what just happened. Brett spat in Vince McMahon's face at ringside. Then he destroyed a whole bunch of monitors. He went searching for Vince backstage, but Vince had locked himself in his office. Undertaker, who didn't even wrestle on the show that night, he was there. He had to go bang on Vince McMahon's door, and he chewed him out. He told him, "You better go apologize to Brett right now." See, when Undertaker tells you to do something, people listen. Just like that little chat he had with Shawn Michaels backstage at WrestleMania 14 when he found out Michaels was having second thoughts about putting over Steve Austin. Undertaker actually talked about that. It may be the only out-of-character, out-of-kayfabe interview I ever saw him do. It was when he was doing the Big Evil character. I think it might have been before WrestleMania 19 in Seattle. Maybe WrestleMania 18 in Toronto. He did an interview with Michael Landsberg on that off-the-record show. And it was a really revealing interview. And that came up. So Undertaker has, in fact, confirmed that story. So Vince went to Brett's locker room. He ended up getting punched in the face. And after swearing to Brett, he knew nothing. And would not even show up on Raw the next night with the title. I'm going to protest what just happened. Shawn Michaels did, in fact, show up on Raw the next night with the title. And he even poked fun at Bret Hart. They brought out the little Bret Hart midget. In case you couldn't figure it out, Shawn Michaels was a major league asshole back in the day. Of all the wrestlers who threatened to boycott Raw the next night and not show up out of protest for the way that Bret Hart got treated, other than his own family members like Owen and the Bulldog, the only person was Mick Foley. Foley no-showed. Bret told everybody else, "Don't do that. I don't want you to jeopardize your own jobs." And born out of this whole thing was the Mr. McMahon heel character who would go on to feud with Stone Cold Steve Austin, make millions upon millions of dollars for the company. So successful, WWE became on the backbone of that Austin vs. McMahon feud. They were able to take the company public in 1999, and 2 years later, they owned, literally owned, their primary competitor, WCW, or at least remnants of it. Believe it or not, there were other matches on this pay-per-view. Yes, there were. Kane made his in-ring debut, beating Mankind. And Steve Austin beat Owen Hart to regain the Intercontinental title in Austin's first match back since Owen dropped him on his head at SummerSlam. Austin's neck was still messed up, and Owen had just suffered a really bad concussion. So both guys were the walking wounded going into this match. And as a result, wasn't very good. Certainly not at the level that you would expect from those two guys. 19 years ago this week, on November 6, 1994, the AAA promotion down in Mexico held its first and only North American pay-per-view, titled When Worlds Collide, which was co-promoted by WCW. Mike Tenay had hosted a wrestling radio show, but I believe this was his debut on commentary. Every other WCW announcer had declined to do the show. They didn't want to do it, which was for the better, because the idea of Tony Schiavone calling Lucha Libre had disaster written all over it. Tenay, and I rag on Mike Tenay now because I just don't find his announcing exciting at all, and I think TNA would benefit getting a fresher voice in there, but back then, he was perfect in this role. He knew a lot about the product, the culture down there. He knew the wrestlers. He knew all the big moves. This is the show that would ultimately earn him a spot on Nitro later on. WCW also started bringing in lots of luchadors and would have Tenay do guest spots on commentary because he actually knew what the hell he was talking about. He was the professor. You know, he would shine during those cruiserweight matches when Schiavone and Bobby Heenan would be too busy talking about what was happening that night with the NWO. So, Tenay was in his element here. He called the show with Chris Cruz, and the match this show is most remembered for is an all-time classic pitting Los Gringos Locos, the team of Eddie Guerrero and Love Machine Art Bar, against Octagon and El Hijo del Santo. Some think it's the greatest match of all time. I wouldn't go that far, but it was an excellent match. You can find it on Eddie Guerrero's Cheating Death, Stealing Life DVD that WWE put out a while back. It was a best of three falls mask versus hair match, where both members of each team had to be eliminated during each fall. They went into the final fall even at 1-1, with the Gringos losing and getting their heads shaved. This would turn out to be Art Barr's last match. He died about 2 weeks later of what is believed to have been a heart attack, but his death is still considered as being due to unknown causes. I've done a bunch of these history segments now, and I've talked about Brian Pillman. I've talked about Magnum TA, guys who had the potential to be so much bigger than they actually were, but whose careers were cut short either by injuries or by death or whatever. Gino Hernandez in World Class would be another one. You can add Art Barr to that list. You listen to people talk about the guy and watch some of his work. The dude could have been a huge star. After that tag match, Paul Heyman wanted to bring him and Eddie into ECW. Supposedly, they had interest from all the major promotions, WWF, WCW, Japan. Eddie obviously went on to many big things. He even started using Art Barr's old frog splash as a tribute to his friend. I'll tell you what, if that had to be his last match, he went out on a high note. And that makes for an appropriate and a very sad segue into what happened 8 years ago this week on November 8th, 2005, on the subject of Eddie Guerrero. Not really sad on this date, but I guess what it led to. WWF taped an episode of SmackDown in Indianapolis, which featured a match between Eddie Guerrero and Mr. Kennedy, now Ken Anderson in TNA, a match that would turn out to be Eddie's last. He and Art Barr going out in similar fashion. Oddly enough, Umaga also wrestled his last match against Ken Anderson and died a few days later. So if I'm Bully Ray, I might be a little worried about that. He won by DQ, Eddie did, after doing his trademark deal where he would trick the referee into thinking his opponent had knocked him out with a chair behind the ref's back. Lie, cheat, and steal, that was his mantra. The win earned Eddie Guerrero a spot on Team SmackDown against Team Raw at the upcoming Survivor Series pay-per-view, but unfortunately, he would never make it to the show. SmackDown aired that Friday, and just 2 days later, Eddie dropped dead from heart failure in Minneapolis in a hotel room. The belief is that he was slated to win the World Heavyweight Championship for a second time that night. They were taping SmackDown on a Sunday, which is what he was in town for, and it was scheduled to be Guerrero, Orton, and Batista for the title, but it turned into a tribute show instead. If there is one positive thing that came from Eddie's death, it was that it spawned WWE's wellness program, the Talent Wellness Program, which came a few months later in February of 2006. In the beginning, the policy, I mean, look, the policy had more holes than Swiss cheese. It's gotten a lot more stringent over time, especially after the Benoit stuff in 2007, but you can trace the roots of the current program back to Eddie's death, and hopefully it's helped and will continue to help save some lives. I miss Eddie Guerrero. You know, it's really a shame because he was always a great wrestler. He was, you know, one of the best, but he never fully clicked in terms of his character and his personality until those last couple of years of his career. At the end there, I mean, man, he had it down. You know, he was so entertaining to watch. But by that point, his body was just so broken down, and you know, he was hurting so badly, and the drugs and everything he put in his body, it just caught up with him. My favorite Eddie Guerrero moment still is when he won the title from Brock Lesnar and No Way Out. It was just such an awesome moment. You know, he made it seem like the biggest thing in the world to him. He had his family at ringside, jumping into the crowd with the fans to celebrate. He's crying. It was great. The match with Mysterio at that one Halloween Havoc, I think it was in 97, was an incredible match. There's the tag match I just mentioned from When Worlds Collide, the matches with Dean Malenko in the old ECW. To this day, he still has the title for greatest counter to a rock bottom I've ever seen. In that match he had with The Rock on Raw, I think it was the only one they ever had together. Maybe if this ends up on tracks, people can chime in with their favorite Eddie Guerrero matches and moments. He would have turned 46 years old this year. And that's this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag, please send them to me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. And you can also send in your audio questions as well. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. We're racking up new followers every week. I live blog during the shows and the pay-per-view, so you can follow me on there for that. Facebook.com/TheSolemonster is our official profile page. We do have a separate fan page that you can like, which I would very much appreciate. And we have a Facebook group. So if you want to be part of our closed discussion group, find it. Just type in the name of the show. Send a request. I'll approve you. And you can be part of what really has turned into a great little community. I'm very proud of it and the people there. You can also subscribe to our channel on YouTube. The Solemonster is my username. Just search us out. You'll find us. Every time a new episode goes up, you'll be the first to be notified of that. I post these bonus episodes of the Sound Off called Sound Off Extra. They usually review a book, a DVD, a pay-per-view that just took place. There's no set schedule for when a new episode will go up. But if you subscribe to the channel when something does, you'll be made aware of that. And our main website is always thesolemonster.com. You can find our archives of all the current and past episodes are up there. A link to our Sound Off Superstore is there. You can make a PayPal donation, which is still the best and quickest way to show your support for the show, is to make a direct donation via PayPal. You'll see the little donate box on the right-hand side. All the people who donated this week, it really does mean a lot to me. And you can keep donating. Just because we hit 300 doesn't mean that you can't keep contributing. So please consider that. and all the different ways that people could listen to the sound off. Stitcher Radio, iTunes, our app in the Google Play Store, we're all over the place. And it's amazing to me to think where the show has gone since episode one. It's now 300 episodes, and today is the six-year anniversary of the Sound Off. 6 years I've been doing this show. It really doesn't feel like it. And to see where we used to be and where we've come from, where we are now, it's really become one of the great pleasures in my life. I legitimately enjoy doing the show. I said it before. I oftentimes will enjoy doing the show and preparing for the show and all that more than watching the actual product on TV. I love it. I hope to continue doing it as long as I can. I don't know if it'll be 300 more. Maybe. You never know. But as long as you guys keep listening and showing your support in various ways for the show, I will continue to do it. I love doing it. I love all you guys. Thank you so much for the support, because without you listening, we wouldn't have made it this far. It is a major milestone. I do understand that. It does mean a lot to me. And all I can say, again, thank you. And keep spreading the good word of the Sound Off, because the best and easiest way for us to reach more listeners is by you letting other people know about us. Whether you retweet things I post on Twitter, share things on Facebook, just tell people, hey, you like wrestling? You like podcasts? Maybe you should check out this guy's show. It's pretty good. And recommending us, writing a review on iTunes or in the Google Play Store. Even that goes a long way as well when people see that. Thank you. Noah Mark, Brian Blade, Webmaster Mike, TV Tracks, thank you so much for all of your support, and all you guys as well. And we'll be back next weekend, as always, with a new episode, episode 301 of The Sound Off. So, until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and in the words of Jerry Lawler, at 10:20 p.m. on a Monday night, we're just getting started. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to The Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
If you don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he can never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a break with Ace's name. I got to get rid of this bastard. I got to get out of this club. This club sucks.
The Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Sala Monster Sounds Off.